often imitated, never duplicated. This is the one and only Fash the Nation, your guiding light in a sea of degeneracy.
Hello and welcome to FTN 299. I'm Jazz Hands McFeels. Got a very full show tonight. I'm joined by James Alsop, as always, and a very special guest, Apache, otherwise known as CEO. Is it Eric Hayden? It's Eric Hayden, right? I'm not on Twitter.
That is correct. Thanks, Jazz. Yeah, it's great to be on. I'm obviously been a huge fan of FTN for a long time, so honored to be on the show.
Oh, appreciate it, man. Well, it's good. I've known you for a while, and very top-level guy. And James, I'm assuming you're still remaining coup-free this week, I hope.
Yes. Yeah, no, still coup-free. And I didn't know that Apache was CEO Eric Hayden. Very good Twitter account.
Yes.
It's one of the three, I think, I follow on Twitter.
Oh, did we just crash your Twitter account with no survivors? Apache? It'll be all right. This is not a show for free fags. This is only for pitch ads. So, you know, free fags aren't coming in here and gumming up the works. It's only pitch ads allowed on this program. So I think your Twitter account will be safe with them. But follow CEO Eric Hayden on Twitter. I'm going to get back on there. I was so close to pulling the trigger on Sunday, but I couldn't think of a good innocuous avatar and a name that, because I can't just come back as me. It's only going to, that shit isn't going to work. But I have a little bit of an opening monologue here in the typical conservative media fashion. I'm going to rip them off a little bit and do a little bit of an opening monologue before we get started. But I just, because, you know, this is amazing. Like, James and I did this, 4 hours worth of content on the weekend show, 3 hours of the regular show and an hour of bonus content for pitch ads only. And it seemed like things turned on a dime on starting on Sunday. And we're going to dig into the detail on that today. And we're even, hold on to your hats here, because we're even going to name the Jew, something that has never been done on any TRS program at any point, at any time. We're actually going to name the Jew, Jew Zero, the very first Jew who started this whole narrative rolling, the Just the Flu Bro 2 spike, the big spike. And, you know, and Mike alluded to this on the midweek tedious today, that, you know, he's seeing a lot of even our guys getting caught up in this. And it's really unfortunate. The last thing that you want to do is be accused of being a line truster. If you're out there trusting the line and you are promoting these narratives and you're doing so in the service of Jews or Jew shills, your problem. So don't be a line truster. You don't want to trust the line. And you also don't want to be an apocalyptic Mad Max collapse trusting guy either. You just want to be somewhere in the middle, which is where we've been since we started talking about this in January. So the key is to just be a nice guy. And being a nice guy means not being a light switch brain. It means not carrying water for Jews. So a simple question that you have to ask yourself, if you consider yourself an upstanding and very supreme white gentleman, is that you should ask yourself, is the take that I'm mindlessly repeating also being repeated by Jews and Jew shills in the service of a higher Jewish narrative? And if the answer to that question is yes, then you need to shut the fuck up, right? It's sort of like America First. America First has been very susceptible to a lot of these narratives. They're like one notch above low IQ Anon, and they get held up in these narratives of supporting this kind of thing. Like, so when you're demanding that the economy be opened back up because coronavirus is just herd or one big deep state conspiracy to wreck Trump and whatever follows and we have to open up the economy and get back to work, you're a line truster. You're a dupe. You're trusting the plan and you're just being caught up in conservatism, Inc. All the people that are promoting that narrative are those folks. So if you're doing that, stop it. Just stop it. And another thing I'll mention too, when you're looking at models, because people that don't know how to read data get caught up in this too. All models are wrong. Emblazon that on your forehead. All models are wrong. But all models, as Mike was saying today, are useful. Models are useful. But if you're going to trust the line and then go trust the model and then use a model to disprove and then support the narrative that Jews are pushing, don't do that. Don't do that. And that's the thing. So the other thing you got to remember is outliers don't disprove trends. So if you find one model out there that says X, first of all, look at who's pushing it. And second of all, try to figure out whether that is even whether that even makes sense. Because you may find a model out there that says X, and it's like, yeah, maybe we didn't get there because we locked stuff down. I mean, you got to really think through this stuff, and I don't think a lot of people are. So don't get caught up in that. Just be a nice guy. Just relax. And dive in, because we actually have quite a bit of content today. Tedious, it's always a marathon to try to fit in tedious by the time it comes out and by the time we do this show. Because most people listen to this show on Thursday, and tedious comes out Wednesday afternoon. And then to consume that content, yeah, you know, I want to make sure that we're not overlapping, we're not serving up things that you just heard, you know, if you listened to their show yesterday. But there's a lot of things that we're going to complement as well, because there are a lot of narratives that they put out there that very similar to what we're going to talk about. We're going to dive into, though, some of the confirmation bias that we've been seeing. And so one of the big pieces of confirmation bias that we have seen take shape is the line, actually, in all of the attempts by the Fed to resuscitate the line. They cut the rate. Then they did an emergency rate cut. Then they added $1 trillion in repo injections. Then they added $1.5 trillion in repo injections. Then they used emergency powers to create a commercial paper facility for overnight emergency liquidity pumps. Then they restarted quantitative easing, or what is it, quantavious easing, I think, changed it to unlimited quantavious easing. Then they agreed to purchase unlimited bonds for the first time ever. Then they agreed to loan directly to corporations, which is something the Fed has never done. Then they did then they started talking about a $1 trillion stimulus. Then it was $2 trillion. Then it was $2.5 trillion. And then I think this morning, yesterday, Donald said, we're going to do a $6 trillion stimulus. I mean, it's just like money printer go brr. And what happened? Big line went down. Big line kept going down to the point where it shaved 10,000 points off the Dow in the last 6 weeks, I think. And so what we've been saying all along on this show is that in our focus has not been so much on like talking about models and disease vector and other shit. We're talking about stuff that we know. And what we're talking about is what the economic reaction to this, which has been a total cratering. So the idea that any of this is one big gay-op, it's like, no, that's not what's happening. These people are losing their shirt out there. And this is a problem that they have fired all of the rounds they have in the bazooka. All interest rates, like three-year T-bills, are now negative interest. And Europe had this going on 6 months ago. So they don't have a good solution for this. And all of the biases that we pointed out have been confirmed. You have, who is this, Tom Barak, I think is his name, saying that commercial mortgages are on the brink of collapse. You have people, can't afford to pay their bills. And the economy is starting to tank. And Jews started to look at this picture and say, you know, like I said on the weekend show, the conversations that they're having behind the scenes are about trade-offs. The things that they're saying in public are different than the things they're talking about in private. In private, they're saying things like, well, how many deaths can we absorb in this crisis and save the economy? And then they have to come up with a good narrative to spin to the public. And, you know, when we closed the books on the Sunday show, maybe it was oversight on our part, but, who would have thought that Sunday night they would have brewed up this narrative? And it kicked off, didn't it, guys? I mean, that was a total pivot right from what they had been doing prior to this, because prior to this, it was just the flu, bro. And then it was, all right, we're going to take this serious because people are dying and we can't, you know, it's bad optics or whatever. And then the economy outweighs these deaths. It does every time. And then the question is how many people is the federal government willing to accept as deaths on the record in order to save the economy? It's a scary question to ask.
And this is a phenomenon we've seen with Trump before, right? Where he will say things, well, he's so brash. He'll just go out there and tell it like it is. And, you know, heavy air quotes, obviously. But what you get with him is this sort of unvarnished honesty, in a sense that when he comes out and says, yeah, this in all caps on Sunday night, the solution can't be worse than the problem. It's like that, you know, that's actually a fairly honest retelling of what the conversation is behind the scenes, right? Because behind the scenes, as you say, they are asking that very question. And this guy just puts that out there. right? And this guy will just come out and openly say, like, yes, we're making a calculation, which is then what you saw backed up in almost all of conservative media throughout the week up to this point.
Yeah, and it's pretty incredible to see Trump's pivot here because, as we know, he waited way too long to respond to this, saying, we got it under control, everything's going to be great, we have one case, it's going to be zero cases in a week. And then waiting until March to make any call. And then once he finally did, I mean, obviously we know it's the state governors who are ultimately making the calls, but there are federal level recommendations that are being handed down. But we know because of the incubation period of this virus that it takes anywhere from 2 days to potentially up to 12 or 14 days for symptoms to appear. So we've only been doing the, you know, shelter in place, stay at home thing for 1 week, and they're already talking about pivoting on it. And it wouldn't have been this bad to begin with if he had just closed the borders back in early February, right, or even earlier than that, but or at worst, you know, mid-February or something like that. But now we have this situation where the economy just keeps going down the tubes and they want to reopen it. I'm just thinking about how embarrassing and just what an epic fail it would be if he were to open things back up on April 1st and then things kept getting worse and then he had to shut it down again.
Well, and that's exactly what would happen. And that's, you know, we're going to get into this a little later on talking about how epidemiologists and everybody else, I mean, this is common sense, right? That when you reopen the economy and you allow people back in places where they will be commingling and touching each other and being around each other, that people are going to get sick again if you haven't contained the virus. And the point we've been making from the beginning, since 6 weeks ago at least, is the only thing that can put an end to the economic collapse is certainty. Right, what the line doesn't like and what people don't like, what's not good for anybody here is uncertainty. So we need certainty. We need to know what is being done at the federal level. We need to know that this pandemic is being properly responded to. And this is sort of the irony of Trump, right, is that in his pursuit, in his slavish devotion to the great line, he actually makes the line more volatile and makes the long-term effects worse for the economy.
He does, and you guys actually touched on a phenomenon that I was going to bring up. They mentioned on Tedious today, and it's this effect of where the just the flu bro takes were part of a strategy that Trump was initially doing, and then they realized that that could be a very positive thing that they could restart, reinvigorate, as they saw that there were not many options left in the economy. Now, one thing that they could do, and we're also going to talk about the bailout and the relief bill that we have said that they, if they really want to make the economy turn around and make everybody whole, it's give everybody a check for $6,000, right? No questions asked, $6,000. And where I pull $6,000 out of the air is because they pumped $2 trillion of liquidity into the government in 1 week. Since they started talking about this, and they could afford to give every man, woman, and child in the country $6,300 with that money that they just pumped into the economy via liquidity. And so, yeah, like this phenomenon that we're talking about as well is they realize that if people start to feel like, yeah, nobody's dying around me and like I'm not actually getting sick and I see very bright, shiny red numbers on a big board, but it's not affecting me personally. Shit, I've never even been in New York City, so I don't even care what those people are doing. Yada, yada, yada. Like, you start to feel this lulled sense of complacency, especially when you're sitting at home, especially when you're bored, especially if you have your income cut off and you're waiting for the government to do something. And they're actually playing games with people a little bit here to make them feel more pain, so they're more susceptible to line trusting narratives. And they've restarted those. I'm going to pinpoint where that started here in a second. But it's this phenomenon where people feel comfortable and then they want to stop taking their medicine. And it leads to a second spike. Second and third spike. You've actually seen this happen in other epidemics, other pandemics. And it's analogous to this actually happens with people who take psychotropic medication. I've never taken any psychotropic medication. I don't know anybody personally who does or who has talked about it. But some people do have to take those drugs. And if you have a mental issue where you have to take one of those drugs, which, you know, no fault, you know, it's not your fault, it's not your problem, and we can debate this some other time if people want. But a phenomenon, a very well-documented phenomenon, is that if somebody with an issue has to take one of those drugs, what happens after they start taking the drug and feeling better and it suppresses their bad symptoms or whatever, they assume that they are better. And then they stop taking the drug and they actually head into a relapse and end up in a much worse situation. And that is a perfect metaphor for what they're trying to do with the economy. Like, pretend everything's fine. We have to go back to work. And part of the problem is that they have already caused, I would argue, so much systemic damage that you can't just restart this. And then now they're caught in a catch-22. And if they do manage to ease restrictions, which Trump is trying to push, then, you know, what's the outcome of that? You know, do these infections start blowing up in places that they were never before? Do you end up with, you know, because it can get a hell of a lot worse than Italy. But let's listen to what Trump has been saying over the past, I don't know, 30 days. I have a montage here. This is a progression of Trump. I think these are like half sentence or one sentence snippets of things that he said over the last 30 days. And you just sound like you're listening to a schizophrenic.
This is a more severe disease.
We have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China.
We think we have it very well under control.
We pretty much shut it down. Coming in from China.
You know, in April, supposedly, it dies with the hotter weather.
People are getting better. They're all getting better.
And the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero.
It's going to disappear. One day, it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
And you'll be fine.
They're going to have vaccines, I think, relatively soon.
We're talking about very small numbers in the United States.
Our numbers are lower than just about anybody.
It's really working out. And a lot of good things are going to happen.
It's going to go away.
Yeah, no, I don't take responsibility at all.
We're going to all be great. We're going to be so good.
This came up. We came up so suddenly.
This is a pandemic. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. All you had to do is look at other countries.
We're 15 people in this massive country. And because of the fact that we went early, we could have had a lot more than that. We're doing great. Our country is doing so great.
Jesus.
Oh my God.
It's insane.
Look, it's going to be great. It's a pandemic. I've always known it with one person. It's like, oh my God.
It's going to be almost zero. Yeah, speaking of psychotropic drugs, you can sort of tell when you have Adderall Trump and, you know, Benzo Trump. Like at the end there, he was going a lot slower. But what you were talking about right before that, Jazz, actually made me think of a great metaphor for this, which is I used to have a good friend of mine that actually worked at a state mental hospital, and frequently there would be homeless people that would come in there, and they'd be there for 3 weeks or something after getting arrested or after having some incident, and they're on their schizophrenia, antipsychotic drugs, but they're not committed, technically. They haven't been forcibly committed or like incarcerated there, for lack of a better term. So what ends up happening is then the state lets them back out on the street because it costs a lot of money to put these people up. And then they go back out on the street, they lose their medication or they forget to take it, and then they stab somebody and kill them, and then they get put back in there. So this is kind of like what Trump is doing with the economy, and it's very schizophrenic, which is, you know, we have to save money, so we're going to let people back out, and then more people are going to die, and then inevitably we're just going to have to, you know, shut people back
in.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, it's horrible. And, you know, you're seeing a lot. Unfortunately, I don't like, you know, all confirmation bias is not a good thing. I mean, I saw just some headlines from The Hill. Coronavirus reveals financial irresponsibility of Americans. Some of that, I mean, that headline is disingenuous, because a lot of the times it's things that people have been propagandized and have had shoved in their face and conditioned to believe that what they're doing is a good action, taking out more credit and building. You're just building your credit, guy. Don't you want to get the Experian boost so you get 750 points on your FICO score and qualify for even bigger cards with bigger API? It's like, oh my God. Yeah, no, and it's like, but the article itself is talking about how people have been left in the lurch by this. And, you know, the macro meta on this is like, if we have an economy that can't, like, let's say that let's just take the Just the Flu Bro people at their word for just a moment for the sake of argument. If Just the Flu brought down the world's biggest economy in a matter of 6 weeks, we have bigger problems than a pandemic, let me tell you. So that is the thing that has to be hit home. And if this whole thing goes away tomorrow, the immutable fact is that this economy is fragile. It doesn't give a fuck about you. You will be grinded into little bits at the moment that the whole thing comes crashing down. And the government isn't going to step in and save you. They are going to, deliberate and, you know, go on and on and on for days and days and days. And nobody's going to stand up for you. Not Bernie Sanders, not AOC. We're going to get into all that a little bit later. But yeah, nobody is writing you a check, no questions asked, that it's going to be enough to get you through this thing. And so it's unfortunate that because people are experiencing financial pain, they're especially susceptible to Shlomo's blood libel, trust the line narratives, which is, yeah, like, we got to get back to work. Can't we do two things at once? Which I'm going to get to here. Before I get to that, though, and this is something, because I think people are looking at line today and looking at line yesterday and seeing big green numbers and points on the board and the media selling this as the biggest rebound since October 2008 and all this stuff. You know why stonks went up in the last 2 days? You know why big line went up and why big line is not going to stay up for a very long time? Big line went up because they were talking on Tedious about, you know, why did big line go up for the cruise lines? Why did big line go up for the airline industries? It's not because anybody's flying on airplanes. It's not because anybody's going on a cruise. It's because they're getting billions of dollars in bailouts. That is why the line went up, because these people are all getting unprecedented historical bailouts. Like, never in history has something like this been done. And so big line is going up because these people are, getting just the tip on a huge windfall. Americans aren't, but they are. And what's coming tomorrow potentially are new jobless claims from the past week, and we don't know what they are. We have estimates. You have again, all models are wrong, but they are useful. So the high is Citibank is estimating 4 million. The low is 860,000, which is UBS. And even if you get the low, 860,000 jobless claims, that is still 10 times, well, no, more like 6 or 7 times higher than they've ever been before. But what we do know is that according to Gavin Newsom today, he said that 1 million in California filed jobless claims this month. Don't know if that was in the last week. Have to assume it's in recent history. So that's just California. And so this news is going to come out Thursday, unless the Trump administration intervenes. I really would find it implausible for them to come out. We're just in a total clown show environment if they come out and say they do that rating scale that we talked about on the weekend, which is like, yeah, don't give them the numbers. Give them the very bad, slightly bad, moderately bad, bad, good, and better number, like the generic description of the numbers. I don't know what it's going to be, but yeah, like that's what they're staring down the barrel of, and it's not going to be good. And that's just for 1 week, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you made a good point earlier. People are under the gun. People are under the yoke of debt slavery. And when people are in this position and they see that any relief they may be getting from Washington is at the very best weeks away, and then you start adding in conditions that this relief is actually a tax prebate. This relief is not enough for anyone to survive on for a month, let alone 6 weeks, which it would be until the next bit of relief from the federal government. People are hard up, as we've made the point here multiple times. And you can get people then. I mean, look, when you have the gun to somebody's head, essentially, say either you go back to work or you starve, government is not going to help you. Like, these are people who will be susceptible to that kind of manipulation, even though they know better, and they know for their health, for the health of their family, and for the health of the country, and for everyone else in it, it's best if they and everyone else stays home. So, yeah, I mean, they really have people in a great position, and that position, their hand gets stronger the longer they deliberate and kick this can down the road on the bailouts, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, this article from The Hill, "The Coronavirus Reveals Financial Irresponsibility of Americans," was super rustling, not just because of the facts in it, which are that only 40% of Americans can afford an unexpected $1,000 expense with their savings, and that nearly 80% of workers are living paycheck to paycheck, but this article by this woman Kristen Tate, who's a former Young Americans for Liberty alumni, it gives this whole like very libertarian-esque like, oh, we need Americans need to have more fiscal responsibility, and you know you want that TV and that new car lease, but you know you should really live within your means. Meanwhile, we know that the airlines and all these other companies that are getting bailouts essentially are totally overextended with debt, and the government is just like, all right, we're gonna give you a bailout. And I find it particularly glaring for the cruise lines, which is not. You can't make any argument that cruise lines are critical infrastructure or critical to the economy. Like, you could maybe make that argument with airlines. But I was just thinking back to the first week of March, there was a roundtable discussion with Mike Pence and the Cruise Lines International Association COVID-19 task force, or they met with Pence's COVID-19 task force. And the president of the CLIA, Adam Goldstein, said it's critical that Americans keep traveling. So this is the same mentality that Trump is giving now, and just totally egregious of this guy to say that. As at this time, like when he said this, people were stuck, people were quarantined on cruises, and we know what happened there. And sure enough, like that Monday, the day I think it was March 6th that he said that, and then by March 8th or 9th he had already resigned from Royal Caribbean, you know, with a bunch of other suspicious CEO resignations that have happened.
Could you imagine if there was an equivalent for, like, we talk about bailouts, right, and these companies that are getting bailouts, well, they should have lived within their means if you're telling me to live within my means. But can you imagine if there were the equivalent in personal finance of a stock buyback, where you could like go down to your local bank and give them, be like, yeah, I'm going to give you $500 and my net worth is going to go up by 25%. So sounds good. And then you just like, oh, there you go. My bank balance is up 25%. Excellent. And that's the fundamental unfairness of all of this. And when you start looking at all of these different like financial instruments and innovations that have been made in the market, It just astounds you how different the treatment is, how different the standards of responsibility are for you as an individual who are essentially told to go pound sand when you run into hard times that are not your fault, versus these financial institutions and large corporations.
Yeah, and their back is up against the wall. I mean, we pointed this out. We've been pointing it out for a while that the economy is in a very fragile state. They don't have a lot of options left. All of the action that they took during the 2008 crisis, while it may have, quote unquote, saved the economy and brought things slowly back onto course, it only made their problems in the macro sense much worse. And if they ever had any problem in the future, which a person who is a serial bettor is never betting on losing everything, but that usually is what comes to pass. And the stock market is just for Grugs, it's just a legalized form of gambling, and they're gambling with everybody's money. And the whole thing is configured in such a way where they win, you lose. And even when they lose, you lose. So, and then they ultimately win. But they are running out of options here. And the metaphor that I use is that, you know, the Titanic is that, you know, you can MMT and keep the ship afloat and from looking like it's listing if you fill up a few watertight compartments. But you start filling up all of them, and there's only so much that they can do. And that's what was happening. Whenever you saw new announcement, emergency action, I read through them at the opening monologue, all of those items that they tried one after the other, and big line kept going down. The stonks dropped like 1,500 points the day after they did the emergency rate cut to zero. So, I mean, these people were schwitzing to death in their back offices and whatever, and they all got on the phone. And they did not like this tack that the president took of finally taking this seriously, because Donald Trump is a sociopath. And, I'm not doing this like, oh, MSNBC, but no, Donald Trump is a sociopath. Raise your fucking hand if you think that Donald Trump actually cares about you personally and cares about your welfare personally, which is a president is supposed to do, by the way. That's what they're supposed to do. And he doesn't. And he is more than happy to consider these trade-offs, but he realized that it was bad optics to continue doing this bit of just the flu when people's loved ones were dying and the situation was getting worse. But again, it comes down to this trade-off where it's like, but our massive golem, though, that we created in the form of the debt slavery, financial capital, whatever, like this whole system that's been constructed, they can't let that die. And the question is, how many lives will they feed into the wood chipper in order to keep that thing running? I mean, they're feeding liquidity. What happens? They're going to have to start feeding you at a certain point, which is what this is. It's like, I think Sven was saying this on Tedious. It's like big line go up because of human incoming human sacrifice. I mean, it's kind of like Jesus, but I mean, you know, so let's pivot into this. So where did this start? Now, guys on Tedious talked about this Medium article. I didn't have time to actually like look into that. But what we do know is that where this started was on Sunday night. It started with a Jew. His name is Steve Hilton. He hosts this program that is the ultimate cringe. It's called Steve Hilton's Revolution on Fox News, and it's a nighttime show. And Steve Hilton is this alopecia head guy who, you know, he's really excited about things, but he talks in a very hip and cool way. It's definitely like a he's got a British accent. He's definitely focused on trying to, you know, the younger crowd Fox is trying to pull in. And he is the guy who floated this in his opening monologue that he said, working Americans will be crushed by the prolonged closure of businesses and the loss of paychecks. You know that famous phrase, the cure is worse than the disease, asked Hilton. And so Hilton, just so you guys know, I mean, maybe you guys will have already smashed early life and you're like, Jazz Hints, it doesn't say that he's Jewish. Well, Steve Hilton changed his name. He's a Hungarian, son of Hungarian immigrants, whose original name was Herksak, and they fled their home during the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, which was a revolution against Jews, Soviet Jews. So why do you think Steve Hilton came to America? Any questions? And I've looked into this guy before, and he's highly problematic, and all the things that he pushes are just such a kosher narrative. He was also a very close political advisor to David Cameron, who has been on record saying that he himself has Jewish ancestry going back to one of his great grandparents. So, I mean, this started with Jews. This whole notion of the cure, what is it? The cure is worse than the disease. A few hours later, Trump tweeted in all caps, "We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. At the end of the 15-day period, we will make a decision about which way to go." And like clockwork, everybody else at Fox started saying the same thing. Monday morning, Laura Ingraham tweeted, "Doctors provide medical treatment and cures. They should not be the determinative voices in policymaking now or at the end of 15 days. In 1 week, we need to be heading back to work. Schools, stores, restaurants, and churches with new protocols in place. The risk if we don't do this is that we lose far more in terms of death and pain and suffering than this pandemic will ever bring." Sean Hannity, a day later, or that night, actually, he said, what did he say? He said he had a letter in his hand from a New York State doctor right here. He didn't name the guy, of course, but he claimed that that guy was treating COVID-19 patients with a regimen of commonplace drugs, and there were zero deaths. Just like magic. It's amazing, right, guys? It's like,
yeah, he was treating with the fish food, right?
Yeah, fish food. Oh, yeah. Yeah, chloro, what is it? Chloroquine? I don't even know how to say it. But, yeah, it's we have the cure, guys. Kudlow was out there. He did this bit, too. Is it in this audio that you gave me, Apache, this Larry Kudlow? Did he say the cure can't be worse than the disease, or is that something else?
I think that he did. I know he's pretty much, like, I think the reason Trump likes this guy is because he just sort of bolsters Trump's ego and just repeats what he says and is like, oh, Trump's amazing. He's such a great guy. So I wouldn't be surprised if he just basically repeated Trump's tweet verbatim.
Yeah, he may have. I won't. We'll save the audio here for a little bit further along. But this is the pivot that they were doing. And you saw this happen on Monday morning as well. There were all these, palace intrigue pieces on the Trump team fiercely debates how long coronavirus restrictions should stay in place. Tensions brewing inside the White House over economic consequences of coronavirus response. You also had this op-ed from Thomas Friedman. And, you know, on the weekend show, we had the freak out from Bill Ackman with the shut it down now guy going crazy. I mean, because these people are terrified. And Tom Friedman, in his op-ed, he says, we need to be asking ourselves just as urgently, can we more surgically minimize the threat of this virus to the most vulnerable while we maximize, this is like the big brain, like libtard article doing this bit. While we minimize the threat of this virus to those most vulnerable, while we maximize the chances for as many Americans as possible to go back to work as soon as possible. One expert I talked to below believes that could happen in as early as a few weeks if we pause for a moment and think afresh about the coronavirus challenge. Like, this is not written for grug brains. This is for like the deep think liberals to take this out too. So they have this injection of just the flu, bro. And we got to do, well, like, there's different flavors of this. There's just the flu, bro, 2.0. There's, can't we do both, right? There's, we have to starve the virus and fight for the economy is another narrative that they're doing. But all of them are promoting this situation where it's just like, we can't keep doing the right thing, which is we have to hunker down and wait and see what happens, because New York State did not hunker down and things are blowing the fuck up there. Italy didn't hunker down and it blew the fuck up. Spain didn't either, and now it's blowing the fuck up. So we have to take a pause and figure out what the right thing to do is. And people get caught up. Line trusters pick up this narrative that it's like, oh God, you're overreacting. It's like, no, I actually care about loved ones that I have, and I don't want them to die. And I don't want stupid people who can be carriers of this virus to carry them and infect people that I love. And I don't want those people that I love to die. It's fucking simple. We have the evidence. Fuck right. All the models. Look what's going on in other parts of the world. I don't think that we should sacrifice our loved ones on the altar of the 90-day moving average of the S&P 500. Like, it's not that hard.
Yeah, I would like to at someday be able to, you know, go to a dentist appointment again. And not kick that down the road for 6 months, or to take, you know, people would like to be able to take their kids to get a checkup, right? And not have to have these things unavailable to them because our national decision has been to essentially just like, we're America and we don't back down from anything. Certainly not a little virus. We fought the Nazis and we can fight this. Like, it's, yeah. Oh my God.
Dude, the World War II. The World War II hyperbole is just so rampant
back
in this.
Back-to-back
just like,
World
oh my
War
fucking God.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
It's like, yo, let's talk about World War II for a second, you fucking piece of shit. You know what virus that you didn't stop in World War II? You killed the cure. You didn't stop the virus. The virus is here now, and the virus is causing the financial pain that we're having now. So you didn't solve that problem in World War II. Pick another metaphor. Fucking slack jaw motherfuckers, dude. Anyway, yeah. I'm getting fucking angry. Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, it's like the decision here is basically the economy or the medical industry and healthcare workers. I know it's not that simple, but basically what's going to happen if we open things back up or open America back up, like, it's just so obvious how Trump refer and all these people refer to America as a business and not a nation, which we know it's not anymore, but it couldn't ever be more clear. But we've seen what's happening in Italy, they have a much better health system than we do, and their health system is pretty much on the verge of collapse. Deaths are skyrocketing. They're having to turn people down, older people. They're basically just having to be like, sorry, we don't have enough ventilators. I guess you can go die now. And for the people working in medicine, people working in the hospitals who don't have the luxury of being at home, I know this is like a normie talking point, but you know, they're really out there putting themselves in harm's way for everyone's greater health. And if everybody just goes back out and the so-called curve doesn't flatten, it's going to essentially collapse the medical system. We're going to have tons of people getting sick. We're going to have hospitals completely overcrowded. We're not going to be able to treat this. And like James said, who knows what the long-term effects this will have on, in terms of doctor availability or people even wanting to get into the medical system after witnessing something like this. I mean, the economy is obviously important, but they're basically making that trade-off, and the trade-off is like, all right, well, we can let all these people die and we can let the medical system crumble, but we can't have the Dow go down another 2,000 points in a day.
Right. And it's a question of time preference too, because if they do that and they preemptively open things back up and everybody gets back out there and goes back to work, you will, as you continue to see more infections and more deaths and more strain on the system, big line is going to go down again. Right. So big line is going to go down. It's just a matter of when you want it to go down and how quickly you would like the recovery to take place. The ironic thing is that, of course, protracts the crisis longer than it needs to be. And the other thing is that in terms of charts and lines and rates of increases and, you know, logarithmic scales and things, Italy and Spain both are, what, 2 to 3 weeks ahead of us, generally speaking, in terms of quarantining, in terms of keeping people inside by force. And I can tell you, being in a state that is under one of these, like, level three, do not travel, do not leave your house unless it's absolutely necessary. Yeah, highway was as busy as normal this morning, right? Highway was as busy as normal. Like, the streets are packed, people are out, people are shopping. So even as we employ these quarantine measures in the U.S., they're not sufficient, and they're nowhere near as stringent as they have been in many European countries. So when you look at that line and you look at the precipitous increase that Italy and Spain and others went through, that's still to come. That is yet to come. And as Italy and Spain experienced that increase, they were locked down. If we do what Trump and his and these media Jews want us to do, then we are going to be just like not only experiencing that rate of infection and death amongst a quarantine population, but in a population where everybody's back out, back to work. It's going to be exponentially worse in the U.S.
It will be. And it's not just, you know, it's not just editorial boards and in medical professionals who are saying this. You have, you know, you have seven medical professionals who wrote a letter to politicians, Save Lives, Not Wall Street. I'm glad there are people actually saying this. You have coronavirus is advancing. All Americans need to shelter in place. That was written by an editorial board. But then you had Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley, who has everything to gain from big line going up, warning that if you lift U.S. coronavirus restrictions now, it could backfire in the manner that James just described. So this is not something that – but it's Trump, right? And this was – a lot of this, you notice who was not at the Monday briefing is Dr. Fauci, because Dr. Fauci went out there after they gave him a very tough interview and said, you know, guy, Donald Trump is saying X, Y, and Z about this, and you're just sitting there being quiet. Like, why don't you do X, Y, and Z? And he's like, look, guy, I'm doing what I can here. Like, there's only so much I can do. What do you want me to do? Like, knock him down and take the microphone? It's like, yeah, that might be a good start, but you know, Secret Service might react in a way that is not so pleasant. But yeah, like, and then Fauci wasn't there on Monday because Fauci is the voice of reason in the room. And all of the voices of reason that have been in the room throughout the Trump administration have been let go, have been pushed aside, some of them for better, some of them for worse. A lot of neocons have been pushed out of the way as well. But you have people like Fauci who were removed because you knew what they were going to do by what they were saying on Sunday and saying on Monday during the day. And then you had Trump come out there on Monday night and saying the U.S. not built to be shut down. It's like, yeah, well, then how about we build a different U.S.? If the U.S. is not built to be shut down, if we can't withstand taking their argument at face value, if it's just the flu and this kills the economy, we have bigger fucking problems.
Right.
But he comes out there and is pushing this. He says there will be more death if the economy is kept shut. And he says, if we're up to the doctors, they say keep it shut down. But we can't do that with the number one economy in the world. I mean, the ghoulish stuff that this is guy. And this is a guy who we said, well, actually, the montage said, Trump said himself in the montage, we're at 15 and soon that number is going to be down to zero. These are just numbers on a board. These aren't human lives. You know, he tries to compare it to automobile accidents. Fauci's like, yeah, that's a huge false equivalency. You don't want to do that. That's wrong. Definitely don't do that. But Trump says we're going to have more deaths. We're going to have suicides, depression, civil unrest. He's using this to scare people. Americans can socially distance themselves and go back to work, he said at a Fox town hall. He says he believes more people will die if coronavirus restrictions are not lifted. And, you know, Fauci was not there at the town hall, and he was asked about that, and he said, oh, yeah, Fauci's got other things to do. It's like, no, he doesn't. Fauci should be the one answering these questions, not you. But Trump I thought he put Pence in charge of this so that, you know, Pence would take the blame for everything. But Donald Trump is just, you know, knocking people down to get to a microphone to do that just all by himself. And, you know, all these sound bites that he's been putting out there. When this is all over, yeah, sure, there are going to be, and look, there are going to be people, even if 5 million people in the country died after this is all over, you have grug brains out there who would say, oh, see, this is a nothing burger, like just absolute, just mind-numbingly stupid people. But you will have Trump, after this is all over, say that he is the one who solved it. But us living in the bizarro clown world that we live in right now, that's clearly not the case that Trump has done. But,
right. Well, that's an interesting thing that he said, that more people will die if we don't open things back up. I guess he's alluding to what the social isolation and suicide. And, you know, that's interesting. But what never seems to happen is people never look at that and ask why that is, because in a different time, that wouldn't be the case. In a different time, you could do what we've done now and shut things down and limit these public gatherings and going to work, etc. And people would be home with family. People would be home with extended family, perhaps. And you would have people to talk to. You'd have people around. But it's very interesting. And, you know, he's not, I don't want to say he's right or wrong, because there is a degree of social isolation people are probably feeling when it's them trapped at home alone with, like, streaming services or whatever. But why is that? Why do we have a society and a culture in which that is the norm? Which this isolation becomes crippling.
Because he knows goddamn well that he is not going to be giving those people the amount of money that they need to survive.
Yeah.
He knows more people are going to die because they're unwilling to give people what they need to survive this.
Yeah.
And ultimately that money would keep them whole, and it would also keep the economy whole. This is one of our narratives. They keep firing the bazooka at the Fed to try to make line go up. You really want to make line go up in a meaningful way? Give everybody $6,000, no questions asked, every single month. Keep doing that. You can pump that much liquidity in a week. You can't pump that much help to Americans that you say that you support and that are your countrymen and your citizens. You can't do that for them every month. I mean, that's like one quarter of the cost of the liquidity you just did in the last 7 days.
Right. Well, and when you look at this total $6 trillion package, sorry, real quick, I mean, that comes out $6 trillion in liquidity and quantitative easing and these securities buybacks. Buying back, by the way, not only mortgage-backed securities, but car loan-backed securities, everything. It's, you know, open season, bring what you got and the Fed will buy it. That $6 trillion bailout comes to about $22,000 per person. So, I mean, if they're stroking checks, like, I want my 22 grand. Don't piss on my leg and tell me it's liquidity.
Yeah, and in case anybody is fooled into thinking that Trump and his Jewish economic advisors care about the well-being of average Americans, I know the listeners to this show don't think that. But just to clarify, social isolation and suicide have been going on in America for years. I mean, the suicide rate keeps climbing with opiate addiction and loss of jobs and the Rust Belt and a million other reasons for social isolation and loss of community. It's only a problem now because it's affecting the bottom line. It's affecting the Dow. But speaking of Dr. Fauci, though, a minute ago, and the people who are voices of reason in the Trump administration sticking around, one person that has stuck around somewhat incredulously is Larry Kudlow, who is Trump's top economic advisor. I think it might be a good time to play that clip now, if you've got it.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. I just wanted to check something really quick. Yeah, of course he's Jewish. Yeah, I thought he was, but you know, just want to be sure. I don't like naming somebody who's not. I've done that before and have had to apologize, and nobody likes to apologize. So this is the short clip of Larry Kudlow.
Is it worth opening up the economy at the expense of public health?
I don't see it that way. I think that public health includes economic health. That's the key point. It's not either or. And that's why we're taking a fresh look at it.
Yeah. Public health is economic health. Yeah, that's how I would look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is how he would look at it. He's not like entirely wrong though, in the sense that people to be mentally and psychologically healthy, they need to have some type of income. They need to be able to pay their bills, and having economic stress piled upon you is not good for anybody's health. But of course, like what he's saying there really is that the status of Big Line, the height of Big Line, is a matter of public health. No, it's not. If you want people to not be stressed out about money, give us $6,000.
It's a matter of his public health. It's a matter of his fellow tribesmen's public health. Because right. Big Line go down, I mean, you know, that's what he's thinking about in those terms. And Trump has to think in those terms as well.
Yeah, if one wanted to have a nuanced take, you know, you can make an argument that people losing their jobs, not being able to feed their family, not being able to pay for medical treatment that they need, or potentially even becoming homeless, that is could be a public health crisis. But as you guys said, that's not what he's thinking about. He's thinking about his dividends and all of his, you know, investments or things he's got lined up for when he inevitably leaves government service.
Yeah, should I play the long one just to see what this
is?
All right. Yeah, 1 second. Here we go.
So if the administration is serious about restarting the economy or part of it next week, why is there a need for a $2 trillion bailout?
Oh, listen. I want to be careful here because the president has put this out there, talked to a bunch of us. If we can target zones where the virus is less prevalent, things are safe, we're not abandoning the health professionals' advice, but there is a clamor to try to reopen the economy and perhaps I'll call it less of a shut-in.
A clamor.
So that's one piece that's yet to be determined, but it's one piece that's being looked at. We still going to need the assistance because in the next week or two or three, you're still going to have a lot of hot zones. You're still going to have a lot of shut-ins. There's no miracle here. We're not just, you know, flipping a switch. So the assistance is so vital. Let me tell you, in a $2 trillion program and $4 trillion of lending power from the Fed, that's a $6 trillion package. And by the way, the Fed can't act fully unless we pass phase two, because phase two contains the increase in the exchange stabilization fund, which is the equity piece for the Fed lending, so that the U.S. government is the guarantor, not the Fed. So those two packages go together. $6 trillion, by the way, is about almost a third of the economy. It's a very big number and covers, as you know, small businesses, payrolls, unemployment, and so forth.
Yeah, but you didn't answer the question, though, Shlomo, which is why do we need this big package if we're just going to open things up at Easter, right? I mean, and that's the big question. It's like, why do you need this big package then? Oh, it's because, you know, all these people are schwitzing for cash and you got to bail them out. But mainly, you have to prop this economy back up, which could not even withstand, 7 days of social distancing? I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, and he said, you know, there's a clamor to open things back up. I don't think there's a clamor as much as maybe there's a chorus of clammy hands rubbing together in Wall Street. But
clammy.
Yeah. And also just the thing that really stuck out to me about this clip was he talked about places that aren't hot spots, you know, opening those back up for business and doing it safe. And it's so stupid because it's like, okay, those places aren't hot spots. I mean, we've seen how this thing is spreading like crazy. What happens when you just open back up a place that's not a hotspot with no plan? Well, it becomes a hotspot. And I mean, to add some nuance there, sure, if you're talking about rural places, and he, both him and Trump mentioned places like Idaho, Nebraska, Iowa, rural farming states where things are spread out, you know, chances are things aren't going to spread there as much. But also, for the most part, those states are full of white people who are not going to sort of violate the stay-at-home orders. They're going to try to make a sacrifice for the, you know, the betterment of the community. And it's just such a stupid plan. But for the listeners who don't know who Larry Kudlow is, or who don't know much about him, I figured it might be useful to do a little background on this guy, a little refresher, to really illustrate just what a scumbag he is. So in Kudlow's financial career in the private sector, he started working at Bear Stearns as its chief economist and senior managing director in 1987. He was also economic counsel to A.B. Laffer and Associates of San Diego, the company owned by Arthur Laffer, who is another supply-side economist like Kudlow and a promoter of the famous Laffer curve that we all came to know during the Reagan administration. And in terms of his government and political career now, this is interesting, or it might not be surprising, but as a member of the tribe, Kudlow has sort of skated between political parties based on what's been advantageous to him. His main thing over the course of his political career seems to be tax cuts. He's a big tax cut guy. He's always talking about how great tax cuts are and trickle-down economics and things like that. But so when he was in 1970, when he was still a Democrat, Kudlow joined Joseph Duffy's New Politics senatorial campaign in Connecticut, which also attracted an A-list crowd of young Democrats, including Yale University student Bill Clinton, John Podesta, and, oh God, Michael Medved, another future conservative.
Wow. Imagine my shock.
Yep. And also, here's another good one. Kudlow began his career as a staff economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, taking a position as a junior economist in a job where a master's degree wasn't required. I'm sure anybody who, you know, doesn't worship Moloch could get that job easily, too. And then he was a part of the Reagan administration. He was the associate director for economics and planning in the Office of Management and Budget. And also, while he worked at the OMB, he was on the advisory committee board for the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, more commonly known as Freddie Mac. So, real great guy. But here's the funny thing. So he was actually when he worked for Bear Stearns, he was fired because of his cocaine and alcohol addiction. So I guess he's also a line truster, but sort of in a different way.
Kudlow's definitely trusting the line in many different aspects, and he's had his clammy hands all over everything over the life of his career.
Yeah, and just two more things that I think are worth mentioning here. So in April 2018, he said the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office was untrustworthy, and he dismissed their estimate that that Trump's 2017 tax cuts and job acts would increase the deficit by $1.3 trillion, saying, "Never believe the CBO. Very important. Never believe them. They're always wrong, especially with regard to tax cuts, which they never score properly." And then it says, "All credible studies of the tax plan, whether by nonpartisan organizations, Wall Street analysts, or right-leaning research organizations, show that the tax plan would increase the deficit." In July 2018, Kudlow falsely asserted that even the CBO numbers show now that the entire $1.5 trillion tax cut is virtually paid for by higher revenues and better nominal GDP. The CBO actually found that the tax cut reduces revenues and that deficits would increase by $1.9 trillion after accounting for macroeconomic feedback.
Yeah, but I mean, like, after all of what we've seen transpire in the last 14 days, is there a single person on this planet that gives a flying fuck about deficits at this point? literally, like, I mean, they're just mad because, like, deficit is bandied about as, like, as bad optics for things that the GOP or whatever. It's, like, part of this kosher narrative, like, this part of the false dichotomy. Nobody gives a shit about this. Nobody looks at the numbers and sees what's going on and actually gives a shit about the ballooning deficit in the country. Like, at some point, like, this is, especially if this heads into a global depression, there's just going to be a moment where everybody is just going to have to cancel each other's debts. Like, we've gotten to the point where it's, like, none of these things are ever going to be paid back. They don't matter because of how much money the government can actually print. And so it's part of this whole thing to, like, whip up, or we have to live within our means, right? It's like a boomer. It's like a boomerism. And, like, when the boomers die, it's just the whole thing is going to go down the toilet. Did you have anything else on Kudlow? Or
I don't give a shit about deficits either. It just illustrates what a liar this guy is. But
he's a liar.
February 25th, 2020, as a coronavirus outbreak was emerging as a global pandemic, Kudlow stated, "We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight."
Wow.
And the best part, I mean, I already mentioned how he left Bear Stearns because of his addictions to cocaine and alcohol. But here's one for you guys. In the mid-90s, after he left Bear Stearns, he subsequently converted to Catholicism under the guidance of Robert C. John McCluskey. So huge BTFO to anybody who says, we can, you know, the Jews just need to convert to Catholicism. You know, that is what that's what Larry Kudlow did. And now he's ruining your economy. So great job.
Yeah, totally reined him in. You really flexed on Judaism by getting them to start praying the rosary, right? Yeah,
did that set a good precedent?
It's a dangerous precedent. Yeah, it's a good precedent, I suppose. It's a very good precedent that we must uphold, is continuing to wallow in this fake and gay dichotomy. But I want to get back on track here with the talking about what conservatives have been pushing, this huge narrative, and Kudlow has been part of it. I have this montage of Fox News, which is going to tee up some stuff that we're going to talk about with Tucker. This is Fox News and the minimization of the disease that they have been doing over the past few days. Here we go.
You want to know how I really feel about the coronavirus, Juan? If I get it, I'll beat it.
I want to tell you the truth about the coronavirus.
This is their next attempt to get Trump.
This is yet another attempt to impeach the president.
The fatality rate's just 1%. So who cares if it's 10 times more lethal than the flu?
The national left-wing media playing up fears of the coronavirus.
We're shutting down our country because of the cold virus.
Coronavirus fear-mongering by the deep state.
The flu is showing much more of an impact on Americans than coronavirus. At worst case scenario, it could be the flu.
All the talk about coronavirus being so much more deadly doesn't reflect reality.
The coronavirus is the common cold.
I feel like the more I learn about this, the less there is to worry about.
I was about to say the same thing.
A lot of people will have this, and it's very mild.
Children are not really affected.
They'll get better very rapidly. They don't even see a doctor. They don't even call a doctor.
But I am far more concerned with stepping on a used heroin needle than I am getting the coronavirus.
We can't err on the side of caution anymore. That's the strategy of losers.
It's called the power of positive thinking.
It's a great time to just go out, go to a local restaurant.
Yeah, it's actually the safest time to fly.
This is the best country in the world to get coronavirus.
But maybe that's just me.
You think we're bad for America?
You think I'm bad for America?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dude.
I love how much of a fucking bonehead Jesse Waters is.
Yeah. You know what, Juan? I want to get coronavirus. I can't wait. And I think later in that montage,
I'm strong enough.
Yeah, he even says, like, this is the best country in the world to get coronavirus.
We've got the best viruses, folks.
And I'm sorry to laugh. I'm sorry to laugh because, I mean, I'm laughing at just the hilarity of these people. But it actually is pretty serious because it just watching Tucker and watching the things that have been said, because two nights in a row, Tucker's had a lot of bad takes. Tucker has come out against UBI. Tucker has been fully on board with the neocon, like China beating the drum, war drums with China bandwagon. And then Tucker is fully on board with this narrative that the cure is worse than the disease and we have to restart the economy. And, it starts to get to the point where, it's the great, actually, I don't like this crisis, but one very positive thing about deep crises like this, and we haven't seen one maybe since 9/11 in our lifetime, and it's really difficult to even compare it to that. But when you have a crisis like this, you immediately see who's really on your side. And the people that are coming out, when the economy is up against the ropes, when the Jewish golem is up against the ropes, and the whole thing is about to sputter apart and spray shit all over everyone, it's really apparent when the people that you thought were out there doing a bit that was advancing your interest, the mask actually slips, and you actually see who they really are. And, you know, Tucker is one of the best. Tucker went out there and had some really fantastic narratives on things. But I have to believe, in hindsight, you know, I'll cheer on anybody who's saying the right things at the right moments. But when it becomes obvious that you are not really in this thing and you're just nothing more than a pressure release valve, I mean, look, I know that Tucker has bosses to answer to and he has things that he has to say and whatever. But you get to the point where you're being asked to put people's lives in danger for your narrative. And yeah, that's kind of a, how's the saying go? This is one of these moments where everything becomes crystallized about Tucker. What do you guys think? I mean, before I start playing some stuff that he did on Monday, I mean, do you agree with me on it or?
No, I do. And I was very disappointed when I saw that. I think we have the Dan Patrick clip and we'll be playing that here in a minute. When I saw the Dan Patrick clip, which is a minute and a half or so of Dan Patrick essentially doing a less characterized version of what we were saying earlier, that like, yeah, I as an old man am willing to go out and die for the line because it's what my grandkids would want. And, you know, Tucker was what he had the face on. So I was hopeful that like after this 90 seconds, like he came back and like demolished the guy. But then you watch the full interview. And no, and then you watch his opening monologue from the next night, and he's repeating and agreeing with many of the same points that Dan Patrick made. Very disappointing.
Which are the same talking points that we've heard since Sunday when they came out of Jew Steve Hilton's mouth.
Right.
It's the same talking points that we've heard from every single conservative pundit on Fox News. This is an all hands on deck, save the sinking Jewish economic ship moment. And that's exactly what they're doing. Listen to this. This is Tucker from Monday night with Lieutenant Dan Patrick.
With this quote, "I don't pretend to be speaking for everyone 70 plus, but I think there are lots of grandparents out there who would agree with me that I want my grandchildren to live in the America I did. I want them to have a shot at the American dream. But right now, this virus, which all the experts say that 98% of all people will survive, is killing our country in another way. It could bring about a total economic collapse and potentially a collapse of our society. So I say, let's give this a few more days or weeks. But after that, let's go back to work and go back to living. Those who want to shelter in place can still do so. But we can't live with this uncertainty." Governor Patrick, Lieutenant Governor Patrick agreed to join us tonight. We're happy that he did. Lieutenant Governor, thanks so much for coming on. So you made clear, and I didn't, I wanted you to say this and not me, but you made clear in this letter that you sent that you're in the category of people who face real risk from this disease. And I thought that kind of put it into perspective a little. Would you explain that?
Yeah, I turned 70 next week, Tucker. And, you know, I sent you a note about a week ago that something has been really heavy on my heart since this started. And, you know, so I'm automatically in the high risk pool. You know, and I'm, as Lieutenant Governor, I work 12 or 15 hours a day, mostly from home now, but I travel when I need to. I'm living smart, listening to the president, the CDC guidelines, like all
no
people
God.
Should. But I'm not living in fear of COVID-19. What I'm living in fear of is what's happening to this country. And, you know, Tucker, no one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? And if that's the exchange, I'm all in. And that doesn't make me noble or brave or anything like that. I just think there are lots of grandparents out there in this country like me. I have six grandchildren that what we all care about and what we love more than anything are those children. And I want to, you know, live smart and see through this. But I don't want the whole country to be sacrificed And that's what I see. I've talked to hundreds of people, Tucker, in just in the last week, and making calls all the time. And everyone says pretty much the same thing.
No, they fucking didn't, you fucking charlatan piece of shit. I'm 70 and I'm in the high risk category, and nobody came and asked me if I wanted to sacrifice myself on this Shlomo economy. I mean, but I surely would. And I tell you that all the people that I've talked to in the last 5 seconds agree with exactly everything. I'm shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Just shut
and
the
you
fuck
want to,
up.
You want to talk about loving your grandkids? I think what your grandkids would love more than a temporary 3-day boost to the Dow Jones trailing average would be to see their grandfather alive, to not have their grandfather die of a respiratory infection. And by the way, you hold up your grandkids as this political pawn. You love them so much, and I am willing to sacrifice for them. Well, you know, you want to go out there and be a part of the economy, and then you want to go see your grandkids. So you want to go and potentially be a disease vector to spread this infection to your 6 grandkids, as we now have stories of 7-month-old babies getting infected with this. We have our first person under 18 in the U.S. dying of coronavirus. No, you want to be a danger to them. You are endangering them with this advice. You would be endangering them if your advice were followed. And you are not only willing to sacrifice yourself for the line, you're willing to sacrifice your entire family. You're willing to sacrifice, Dan Patrick, your entire progeny, your future, on the funeral pyre of the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Yeah, what's that what's that famous libertarian saying? It's like, I may not be a millionaire, but I'll lay down and die to make sure their stock prices go up.
Well, it's not even, and on top of that, it's the implication that there is some future for his grandchildren that is worth lying down and dying for. And lying down and dying for the line on top of that. But let's say that the line didn't exist. You're going to lie down and die for the 2 million illegal immigrants who flooded into the border in the last 6 months? You're going to lie down and die so that trannies can read stories to their children, to your grandchildren's children at story time? You're going to lie down on the line so that your taxpayer dollars go to elective surgeries for these fucking disgusting people? I mean, the list goes on and on. The idea that, oh yes, now that there is a destiny and a future for America, talk that I haven't heard in a long time, because if they talked about it in any other context, would be getting way too close to the line of white supremacy. But no, when it's about with big line go down, oh yeah, we can trot this back out again because we need all these boomers parroting this shit. I actually talked to some people that I know that are in this age category, and I just to do a litmus test and see, like, have you seen this rhetoric? And they're like, oh yeah. And they were disgusted by it. So this is, you know, we talked about it early in the show, the notion that this is going to fail because it's going to get overtaken by events in the next couple of days with economic news and the rapid increase, exponential growth in deaths and in cases. The idea that this was going to be something that was going to work for them, I mean, they didn't think about this, but it shows how desperate they are. It shows how desperate and craven and ghoulish they are to even trot this out, that wheel this 70-year-old lieutenant governor out to tell these stupid boomers what to think. And no doubt some of them will. Some of them will, but it's such an egregiously irresponsible narrative that you're already seeing this thing starting to get rejected. But you're seeing it evolve in some ways. Tucker came out on his show on Tuesday, and first thing he did was attack Andrew Cuomo, and we're going to talk about that here in more detail. But the other thing that he did was he listed out 3 tip-top priorities. Tucker's 3 big top priorities are big line must go up, China very, very bad, and Twitter won't remove mean things China is saying about USA. Those were like the first 8 minutes of Tucker's show on Tuesday night. And he also attacked Andrew Cuomo. And I'm not a big fan of Andrew Cuomo. I'm not supporting Andrew Cuomo. I don't want Andrew Cuomo to be the next president, although he may, you know, give Biden a run for his money. Cuomo, the reason why Tucker was attacking Cuomo in the beginning of the opening monologue is because Cuomo was actually, I'm going to give him a little credit here, was smartly responding to all of the fake and gay conservative rhetoric of the past 48 hours. Cuomo came out and said his mother is more important than the stock market. And what does Tucker do? The very first thing is he says that Andrew Cuomo is engaging in needless moralizing. That's ridiculous that someone would say their mother is more important than the stock market. Nobody thinks that. It's like, Tucker, that's what everybody on your fucking network has been saying for 48 hours. That's what everybody is pushing. And you are too. And, you know, it kind of just going back to Tucker for a second, you know, you wonder why Tucker's still there. You wonder why he didn't get taken down. You wonder why the protests have stopped at his house. You wonder why he doesn't see much opposition from the left. No matter what he says, maybe we know why now, because he's right. Willing to toe the line when it matters.
Yeah. And the theory that Ben Shapiro was going to be his teed up replacement. Why would they replace him with Ben Shapiro? Because he's saying exactly what Ben Shapiro would say. I haven't checked in with Ben Shapiro's takes on this, but I'm sure that, well, I'm Ben Shapiro and I'm Jewish, and nobody thinks their grandmother is less important than the line. It's like, this is exactly what he's probably saying on his Daily Wire, Jeremy Boring, Jew Town, Jew Fest, Jewy podcast. So, like, why replace him? Tucker's doing the bit just fine.
Yeah, criticizing.
Boring is both a proper name in that sentence and an adjective. It's boring and it's produced by a guy, Judy. Yes. Boring. Anyway, sorry about you. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's criticizing Cuomo pretty much the one time he's done something right and is actually really looking like a leader. I also thought it was interesting, you know, about 10 days ago, there were stories that Tucker had gone down to Mar-a-Lago to talk to Trump about the coronavirus to get him to take it more seriously. And we saw a shift in Trump's tone and suggested policy pretty much right after that. I'm wondering if now this was something like after Trump listened to him, Trump was like, all right, Tucker, I did something for you. You got to go out there and tell people to get back to work now.
Well, I don't even know that Trump had to give Tucker explicit direction. I mean, I just think that he told Tucker, like, here's what you're going to do. And, you know, if you don't do this, I mean, everything, you know, he doesn't even need to tell him in very explicit terms. Tucker's not a stupid guy. I do think, though, that Tucker, I mean, look at all the bad takes that Tucker has. I mean, if people are like, but you guys always said that Tucker is great. It's like, yeah, Tucker was great when Tucker had good takes. But now Tucker is coming out against UBI. Tucker is coming out and being a cheerleader for fucking China shilling, anti-China shilling. He's also coming out now and doing the fucking bit that is so transparently obvious when the economy is going down in flames that we must all go back to work. The pandemic be damned. So, yeah, no, it's fucking stupid. It's gay. There is no upside. Like, we've looked at this from every single angle. We don't even have to defend this position. It's so transparently bad. And, you know, I mean, there's not a lot to like about Andrew Cuomo. I don't like Andrew Cuomo. I don't like the things that those guys have done. Their policies are bad. So light switch brains have to, like, take a seat and figure out what's going on here. But Cuomo is saying he's responding in the way that I would, which is that, yeah, guy, like, my loved ones are not less important than the stock market. Like, we're going to do everything that we can for everybody in this city if I were the governor of New York, which I'm not and I never would be. But yeah, New York is kind of a shit show right now. And New York City specifically, I think, Apache, you wanted to talk about these NYPD, 211 NYPD officers have tested positive for coronavirus so far. We don't know how many of them have been hospitalized. But one big thing is that of the, 30,000 cases that are in New York City so far, 3,800 people are in the hospital. So 3,800 people have been hospitalized in New York City already, which just BTFOs any fucking model, this outlier model that anybody wants to throw at this. It's just not realistic. So it's a shit show, but it's also becoming a shit show for a very special, very important, very elite group of people. Is it not, Apache? This is just incredible.
It is. Yeah. Things are getting really bad in New York all around. As you said, you know, there have been 211 positive cases of coronavirus among NYPD officers. And on top of that, there are almost 3,000. There's 2,774 NYPD employees who were out sick on Tuesday, March 24th. That's about 7.6% of the department's uniformed workforce. So you guys were talking last week about the spike in crime that could and probably will happen I think this is definitely an indication of that. But yeah, more importantly, like you said, there's a certain community in a certain borough, Brooklyn specifically, that is having a bit of a different reaction to the coronavirus than everybody else, both in how they are listening to the recommendations to stay at home and the rapidness with which it's spreading through their community. So there's an article from, I'm just going to go in order of a few articles here. It's kind of a four-part story. So we start with an article from the Jewish Daily Forward. White House calls Hasidic leaders asking them to take the virus more seriously. An assistant to the president, I think Avi Berkowitz, called on rabbis and leaders of the Orthodox community to help reduce gatherings of more than 10 people to prevent the spread of coronavirus. There is a video, I'm not going to play it, but it's a bunch of rabbis huddling over a landline phone that's on speaker talking to assistant to the president, Avi Berkowitz, who... just happened to become friends with Jared Kushner after they met playing a game of pickup basketball. You know how that just happens? You meet somebody, and then next thing you know, you're working in the White House with them because their father-in-law is the president. So Avi Berkowitz says, "I know we all consider davening with a minion to be extremely important, so I'm not saying this from a soft point. Minion is a Jewish ceremony that, you know, there's basically a Jewish holiday every 2 weeks. So this is one of them. And it's funny because these people can't just follow the rules. They have to get basically a call from the president to the leaders of their communities to be told what to do. And despite that, they still don't listen. So we have the next article, which is Hasidic community ignores social distancing orders amid coronavirus. And we have it starts out with a tweet from Jacob Kornble. It says, "This is not cool. An outdoor wedding with that many participants in a cramped backyard is just as dangerous." And it, you know, shows all these people, you know, wearing black jackets and hats and sidelocks, dancing in a circle as they do. Members of New York City's Hasidic and Orthodox Jewish community openly defined social distancing orders Tuesday by hosting raucous weddings with hundreds of guests amid the growing spread of coronavirus. A wedding at Atarez Avra home in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, was shut down around 4:30 p.m. Tuesday after community members complained to City Hall, which sent the Fire Department of New York to clear it out. And then next article, coronavirus, huge spike in Brooklyn Hasidic community. More than 100 tests positive in two communities, all at two urgent care centers crammed with worried families. Outside the Assisa Urgent Care Clinic in Borough Park, Brooklyn, where a crew arrives to clean the facility before it opens, Hasidic residents are huddled in lines waiting to be treated. So, and then it says, at a news conference on Tuesday, Mayor de Blasio said there were no known clusters of coronavirus in the city, and a cluster is an interconnected group of cases that can be traced to the same source. Such a group emerged in New Rochelle this month. We know what cluster that is, and it's pretty clear that the first cluster in New York, although they're not saying it, is in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, in Borough Park, where this is happening. We have Joel Bernat, an executive at the cleaning company Disinfect New York that has been cleaning these medical facilities, said his company had been called to Assisa Urgent Care twice in the last 2 weeks after patients tested positive for the coronavirus. He said the city should have issued stronger warnings about the coronavirus 2 weeks ago and that the neighborhood was at risk because its residents live very close together. Doesn't matter that this has been in the news for, I mean, I guess if people are watching Fox News, maybe they'll get the wrong advice, but doesn't matter that this has been in the news for months, basically, and the Hasidic community got a call directly from the president's office to do this, and they didn't listen. Also, it also mentions another choice thing. The Hasidic community in New York has grappled with epidemic illness in the past. A measles outbreak that began in New York in 2018 led Mr. de Blasio to declare a public health emergency last April. The Hasidic community was disproportionately affected by that outbreak. But now, guys, in case you're thinking that this has anything to do with selfishness or not playing by the rules, we have a good explainer here from a journalist named Meyer Labin in the Jewish Journal with an article titled, "Why Coronavirus is Spreading Rapidly in the Hasidic Community." She says, "A vicious rumor has been making the rounds. Hasidim are neglecting to take the coronavirus pandemic seriously because we are selfish. This is not true. The first major obstacle is access to information. There are virtually no televisions in Hasidic households, as well as very limited access to the internet. Many people weren't aware of the developments leading up to the crisis, the severity of the situation, and official announcements as quickly as those who live in constantly online communities." And then the second major reason this pandemic has spread rapidly in the communities has to do with physical space and social interaction. You know, as we know, these people basically live on top of each other in little termite nests. But the best part is at the end here, the explainer for the reason why Hasidim might not be following the rules, might think a different set of rules applies to them than everybody else. She says, "Generational trauma also has a huge effect on my community's ability to accept extreme measures imposed from the outside. Shutting down synagogues and schools inevitably brings up dark memories in a community that consists primarily of descendants of Holocaust and persecution survivors. It's natural that leaders are extremely reluctant to accept such measures."
Well, that's why they've been so hands-off with this. That's why all of the governors have been very careful. We talked about this in the weekend show where they're saying, yeah, we're recommending that people remain at home and, you know, shelter in place. But, you know, we can't go much further than that, you know, because blah, blah, blah. But they can. And we explained all the reasons why. And some of the governors, like Newsom, said, yeah, we're going to do martial law if we have to, because Newsom has, a very sizable population of people who could become problematic. And so he sort of has to remind people that, yeah, like we have to do, if we have to do this, we have to do it. And I mean, this has been pointed out before. It's been pointed out by others, including us on our own podcast as well, is that all of the measures that have been done, and Borzoi said this on the last midweek show, it's the solution to the problems of liberalism are illiberal, right? And so the things that they're talking about needing to do are perceived by Jews are fascistic. And they don't like that. And not only do they not like it, but they just go ahead and do whatever the fuck they want. That's why we play that audio on the weekend show of the cops telling the Chabad Lubavitch world headquarters that it had to break up and disperse because they were gathering in large numbers. And yeah, it's like they don't want to disperse. They don't want to disband. They don't want to go into their shtetls and stay away from all of this. And the problem that the government has is if they start having to tell these people to do that, then it becomes even like an oh god oy vey problem. And yeah, it's kind of funny, like you said, like the White House had to make a very special call to New York to make sure that these people were following the rules. And it's like, how dare you tell us to follow the rules? It's just amazing. But there was this headline from Tablet Magazine: "America's largest population of Holocaust survivors is endangered by the coronavirus as Crown Heights and Borough Park shut down." It's like, my God, all these millions of survivors spread out across New York. It's just like, Jesus, man, it's just never ending.
Yeah, it would really suck to survive the flying eagle and bear and pedal powered brain bashing machine, only get taken down by a virus. That would really suck. Well, you know, the other thing here is that the more the virus spreads in these Hasidic communities, the more money they can ask the federal government for, too.
Yes.
Right. There's this new push. And they've done this before with the fake threat of shootings and I need $1 million for my synagogue because somebody spray painted it. Somebody that definitely wasn't me. Right. And so they're doing the same thing now. They're asking for National Guard protection, asking for DHS grants to protect against neo-Nazi coronavirus threats, which, of course, as that one whistleblower pointed out, That money just becomes fungible and is oftentimes spent for things other than security.
Yeah, things other than security. And it's gotten pretty rough in New York. I mean, for the caved in Wojak heads, 48% of New York City cases are under 45. The problem is exploding there. For the people that, you know, don't think this is being taken seriously, that this is all fake and gay, I mean, it was announced this afternoon that the Pentagon has issued a stop movement order to all U.S. troops, civilian personnel, family members. Everybody has told them to stop movement, basically shelter in place, halt all travel and movement abroad for 60 days. And Minnesota, which has very few cases, has now issued an executive order directing Minnesotans to stay at home for 2 weeks. And so, yeah, I mean, this continues. And that's the upside. So if you're worried about the virus in the way that we are, which is that, look, any death is unacceptable. And the potential and what we know about, you know, the comparisons to the flu are just retarded, and pneumonia and everything else are just retarded for the simple fact that of how this thing is spread and how deadly it can be and how much of a roll of the dice it can be. That's the problem. And so we've sort of beaten our head against the wall with this and telling people. But, you know, you still have people out there like Jesse Kelly saying, if given the chance between dying and plunging the country into a Great Depression, I would happily die. Even Ann Coulter was getting into the act on Tuesday, where she said she posted a graph for people to look at that said for people under 60, coronavirus is less dangerous than the seasonal flu. But she got blown the fuck out. And I normally like Ann Coulter, but, you know, maybe she's headed in the direction of Tucker. I don't know. She got well, actually, pretty hard on this, because the graph that she posted actually shows that coronavirus is more dangerous than the seasonal flu for everyone over the age of 30. She got blown the fuck out on this. And, so she even tried to get in on the act of doing the just the flu bro bit. And, it didn't work out for her. Not such a good move, Ann. Maybe you should just stick to attacking the president for his bad immigration policies. That was a good corner of the market that you had, and maybe you should stick to it.
Right.
Go ahead, James.
Oh yeah, I was going to say that this is it's just the flu bro, but it's almost a capitulation that just the flu bro wasn't right, because a week ago, 2 weeks ago, they were saying it was just the flu bro. There's no reason to worry. Now it is. It's hard to put it into words, like exactly how depraved this is, right? Because they're admitting that this is fatal. They're admitting it's highly contagious, and they're admitting it could kill you. But all of that is taken into consideration, and still the sustenance of the perpetual motion machine that is the American economy comes first. Right. So I think Jesse Kelly actually puts it fairly, very succinctly when he says that, he would rather die to feed this fire.
Yeah. And on top of that, I mean, they mentioned this on Tedious, and I think it's true. For the people who were doing hype, and that was mainly the government and others for a little while, especially medical experts, is they know, given the obesity in the country and all the problems that Americans have, they know that people don't follow health guidelines. And so there is a strategy, and Alex was talking about this, that hyping this harder than it actually is, and it's bad as it is. There are some models that showed it being a lot worse, and one of them, I forget what it is, the Imperial College of London, it's like you have them saying it's going to be, you know, unmitigated 2 million deaths or whatever, and then on the other side it's like just the flu bro and whatever. But, you know, this game that they're playing, it's if you're going to get people to stay inside, and look, the hype that they did wasn't enough. Like you just said, you go outside and you see a lot of people still walking around. I've seen videos of bobbies in London kicking people off of the green because they are not adhering to Bojo's order. And now Britain was not taking this seriously a week ago, but now they are. They've shut down Britain as well. And you're seeing shutdowns go on all over the world. In fact, India, where it hasn't even happened yet. I mean, I didn't know this until I read into the details, but I thought when Modi went out and put Indians, these Pajits, on a lockdown, I thought it was just going to be a shelter in place like the rest of the United States. But no, It is actually confined to homes for 21 days. Now, I mean, unless all these people are looking at the same shitty model, I think these people are taking an abundance of precaution because they've seen what has happened in other places. And if you let off the gas, it's going to tend to get pretty bad. I mean, you know, you have places like Mexico, who has basically, Obrador is doing the Jair Bolsonaro bit, which is, and the Trump bit, actually. These guys are saying that this is an effort by the media to destroy my presidency, which is kind of funny that they're using this narrative. But in Brazil, where Bolsonaro has been going out and, you know, doing, yeah, just the flu, bro, the media is hyping this, yada, 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 you actually have drug gangs going into the favelas and imposing curfews. Like, gangs and militias are the ones who are going into the ghettos, into the favelas in Brazil, and saying, yeah, we're imposing a curfew because nobody is taking this seriously. Whoever is in the street screwing around or going for a walk will receive a corrective, this is a translation, and serve as an example. Better stay home and do nothing. The message has been given. So, I mean, leave it to the gangs, right? In the center of the city of God to tell these Brazilians that they have to stay home for their own good. I mean, you know, the gangs are acting in their own self-interest. If people start dying from disease, like, who are they going to sell the drugs to, right? Like, so, you know, it's they're trying to save their economy in a different sort of way, I think.
Yeah. Well, in India and Mexico and many of these other countries, anywhere from what, 5 to 20% of their national economies are dependent on remittances. And India is in a much better position to weather this because much of those remittances, in India's case, are coming from white collar workers that are probably still working. Right. So the impact, the direct impact on India's economy is actually going to be less than the impact on, relatively speaking, than the impact on the Mexican economy, for example, or even you could argue the U.S. economy.
Yeah. Well, hey, Pat, did you have one? Want to give your take, and then I'm going to wrap the first half here, and we'll go to the break.
I was just going to say, if President Modi were smart, he would just tell all the Indian men that if they stayed in their homes for 21 days, they would get girlfriends at the end of it, and I think that would probably work like a charm.
In 21 days, we will show you all Bob's and Vagin, and you just have to commit to this. But yeah, what was I going to say? Oh yeah. So we've sort of covered this like from top to bottom, and given our very thorough takes on this. And, you know, I'll stand behind him. I'll stand by everything that we have said on this so far. So don't trust the line. Don't fall into this sort of retard shit that you're doing. This is a very serious thing. And do it for the sake. If you're not doing it for your own sake, do it for the sake of somebody else's loved one. Because people are dying from this. People who are young are dying from this, and you don't want to roll the dice. Things to look ahead for. So I believe, I could be lying to you right now, but I believe that Sunday marks the day that Trump could decide to change the guidance on the quarantine. Now, we're going to be obviously doing another show before then, so we'll see what happens with that. But the good news is, if you're in our camp, and it's the only smart camp to be in, let's be honest, that if you're worried that Trump is going to open this back up and expose everybody, Trump didn't make the rules, remember? Trump delegated to the states from the beginning on this. And so Trump can go ahead and lift restrictions and do whatever he wants and walk around, I don't know, whatever he wants to fucking do. But it's the governors who have set the rules here. And Trump delegated to them. And so if you live in a good state that has a governor who has done a good job with regard to this scenario, then you're probably going to be in good shape, because Donald Trump can ease restrictions all day long, and it's ultimately up to the governors to protect their people. And so far, they have been resistant to this narrative that Trump has been pushing. So, I mean, I guess if you live in a state with a big, you know, plan trust and line trust and GOP vote and governor, then you might maybe be in some trouble and you just want to continue your own quarantine for as long as possible. But that's what we're looking at on Sunday, is potentially Donald Trump is looking at this. I know he said Easter, but Sunday is the end of the 15 days of social distancing. So he'll either extend or relax. We don't really know. But we have a long first hour here on FTN. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to be right back after this little break to talk about the quote unquote, well, it is a bailout, and the quote unquote bailout of you. We're also going to talk about a few other things as well. So we'll be right back on FTN.
listening to the show that changed your weekend forever. Fash the Nation. Fash the Nation. To Fash the Nation, heard only on the TRS Radio Network.
Hello and welcome back. Hour 2 here on FTN. And as you've probably seen, normies outside periodically checking their mailboxes, insistently hoping they're getting their Trump bucks, their big, beautiful $2,000 a week family bailout. Well, that bill has actually been kicked around Congress for another week, and as of press time, still no approval, right, guys? We're still waiting for the Senate to, the Senate and the White House have struck a deal, but now we're waiting on that deal to actually be approved by the Senate, and we're waiting on the House to come back and vote on this. So, yeah, what have we been doing now? Almost 2 weeks of social distancing, and still no bailout in sight, no bailout for you as a regular American, and not even a bailout for these corporations, which has been, of course, their priority throughout this entire process. How much longer do you guys think this will take before we get some semblance of a legislative framework?
I don't know. I think sounds like they want to cause as much pain as possible, and still not give people what they want at this point. I mean, they keep saying, "Yeah, we're going to mail out checks in probably early April." In April sometime, mid-April, and how long before that's like end of April? And meanwhile, a lot of people were let go in the week starting 9th of March, and, you know, it's like, what's their last paycheck, the 20th? I mean, yeah, it's going to start to get pretty dicey out there, which we've talked about quite a bit. And this bailout bill, keep in mind, I mean, it's only something that the Senate has signed off on, they've voted on. It still needs to be passed by the House, but you're even getting 11th hour as of Wednesday night. You're even getting 11th hour objections from people like Boney Jew and even some Republicans. And we're going to get into the details on that. But yeah, this amounts to a massive and massive is an understatement. It's the largest bailout in history. It makes TARP, which was $700 billion. It makes TARP look like nothing. Like the defense right. budget makes the TARP look like nothing. I think they're about equivalent. But yeah, it's just this is where we are right now. And Trump is saying that it's not going to be the only one. It's just phase XYZ 1, 2, 3. I mean, we're going to do as many of these as we can. And yeah, I mean, it's just like people on the other end are probably starting to get pretty nervous because it's like Donald, there's only so much of this that we can do and maintain credibility. But now we're going to do whatever we can to save it. It's not going to be a very pretty thing, and it's not very pretty for you. And I like the argument that people have made, which is that why don't you just go and do, you know, this is like, imagine a government that works well for you. It's like, why can't you just have one piece of paper that says, this is what we're going to, this is the bill that is going to make the people hurting the most whole. You do a bailout bill, whatever. I mean, we could argue about that all night if you want. But just why not just do a bill that's one page that says we're going to give each man, woman, and child in America $6,000, no question asked. The checks will mail on April 3rd. And that's mm-hmm. it. Like, period, end of story. And we'll renew the. And like I said on the weekend show, this will renew every month until Congress comes back and votes to end it. Like, it just continues right. until they vote to end it. Like, they have to vote to end it and make that a big show. And they can only vote to end it when the whole thing's over. One piece of paper, not 1,400, one piece. That's all you have to do. And they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it for a number of reasons. They're not going to do it because they don't want people to actually see that they're capable of doing it, first of all. They don't want people to get used to this. And they don't want to see that, actually, you know what? The outcome of this is actually going to be very positive. And, you know, people are going to start to wonder why this hasn't been done all along whenever we've had problems, all the suffering, all the death. I mean, Donald Trump himself is out there saying people are going to die. Well, write him a check, Donald. You don't want people to die? Write him a check. It's not that hard. Go ahead, James.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And they're bringing up this this tactical deficit concern, which we alluded to in the first hour, which is losing credibility by the day as they try to use this. But it is so funny how they will mention, well, how are we going to pay for $1,200 per person? How can we possibly ever conceive of paying for that? Meanwhile, it's unlimited Fed debt buybacks, unlimited security purchases, etc. And you're right. One would think, and again, if you're listening to this, you understand the system does not work for you and has no interest in working for you. But someone that had a shred of hope the system could, in times of pandemic, work for them, the logical solution here is, all right, we all agree on, let's say we do the $1,200 per person and $500 per child. Okay, if we all agree on that, let's pass that, and then we can hammer out all of this garbage about extra, which is not garbage, but all of these other particulars about extra unemployment and funding the Kennedy Center and everything else that we want to do with this bailout thing. Like, we'll hammer that out in the following days. Right now, let's get the presses rolling on these checks. But as you mentioned, one of the hangups they're facing now is Bernie Sanders and Lindsey Graham, Tim Scott, Ben Sasse, in this reaching an impasse over unemployment benefits, as I understand, Jazz. And they're objecting to this Democratic addition to the bill that would guarantee $600 per week on top of what people get in their state unemployment benefits, right? Because unemployment is administered by states. This would add an additional $600 from the federal government to people who are qualifying for unemployment. And, you know, when you do the math on that, and this lasts up to 4 months, do the math on that, that could be a pretty decent amount of income for someone, couldn't it, on unemployment?
So much money that, according to Lindsey Graham, the way that you do Lindsey Graham, by the way, and I probably repeated myself on this, is that you close your nasal passageway and then you just talk. So Tucker is Tugger. You just say, you want Tugger, I'm telling you, Tugger, you want to destroy what's left of the economy, pass it the way that it's written, okay? If you want to help people, pay them their wages, but don't pay them more not to work. And that's what the hang-up is with these guys. There's a Fox News headline, GOP senators flag massive error in coronavirus bill that they say could encourage widespread layoffs and total catastrophe in the marketplace. And we can't have all these layoffs because that might hurt the workers. But when you read actually what they want, is they're very deeply concerned about the current version of the bill, which would pay workers more in unemployment benefits than they're currently making, which, according to calculations of Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott and Ben Sasse, all the usual suspects, and Rick Scott, you know, this could lead to disruption in the labor market that they warn about. Not layoffs, just disruption in the labor market, because employers might decide to just fire people or somebody might quit. But you don't get unemployment if you quit. So you'd have to be fired. So none of this makes sense. And all of this is a bunch of Jew shills going in there and trying to take away what actually would have been, unironically, and I'll just say, would actually have been not so bad of a thing. Because the average unemployment in the country that people qualify for, if you make more than $24,000 a year, which most people, if they're working, they do. Look, if somebody comes into the comments and says, I only make $18,000 a year, well, Jesus fucking Christ, I don't know what to tell you. You got to make $24,000 a year. It's like, you can put yellow smiley Walmart stickers on people coming in the door and hand them a shopping cart for more than $24,000 a year. But anyway, what I'm getting at is that basic unemployment, if you make that minimum amount, if you're working and you work for, I think, what, 20 weeks or something, each state has its own rules. Anyway, the average is between $300 and $500 per week in unemployment. And what this bill would do is give people 4 months of $600 extra per week, not per month, per week. And so if, let's say that you get $400 a week from your unemployment plus $600, that's $1,000 a week, which is $4,000 a month. That's even before this fake and gay prebate check that we don't have the version. You know, of course, we don't have the language of the bill. Nobody has language of the bill to read and understand. But they are trying to come in and say, oh, God, we can't possibly, let's say that you take the prebate check on top of that, we can't possibly have someone getting their grubby little shitty hands on $5,200 a month. My God, they might even be able to feed themselves, and we can't have that, right? Like, that's what the Republican Party is standing up and holding up this bill for. And it's this is what everybody needs to understand what they're actually doing. Because boomers are going to read this headline and think like, oh, these Republicans, they're standing up because they don't want workers getting laid off. It's like, no, they actually want to take as much money away from the workers as they possibly can. And, you know, it sounds like a libertard talking point, but no, it's actually true. I'm saying that based on reading the Fox News article. I don't even have to read anything else to understand what they're doing. And, you know, the clammy, clamoring hand-rubbing is going on behind the scenes in a vigorous format.
Yeah, and of course, we would prefer for this not to be, for this money, the $600 a week, not to be tied to unemployment. Because while we're seeing, what is the number now, about 20% of the country, and this, there's, of course, a trailing period on these polls, but as of a few days ago, 20% of workers have either lost their jobs or lost hours because of these various economic shutdowns and loss of demand. But a lot of these people aren't actually losing their jobs, right? Because to collect unemployment, you need to be let go. But if you just have your hours cut to a quarter of what they were, or you are temporarily placed on leave, and again, this depends on the state and the exact contractual language that you're in with your employer, but in many cases, you can have your hours significantly reduced or the amount of money, your income significantly reduced, and not qualify for unemployment. Or if you're a small business owner and you're unable to conduct business, odds are you also don't qualify for unemployment. So there are plenty of ways in which you cannot qualify for unemployment. You can be a worker working a good job and not qualify for unemployment.
It's very hard.
Which is why
it's very hard to actually get unemployment because of you know, all the things that you have to say and do if you're put in a situation where, you know, you've been fired for cause. Like, you're not going to get unemployment. And if you quit your job, you're not going to get unemployment. But what they're saying here, and this is Tim Scott, Sasse, and Graham in a joint statement, a massive drafting error in the current version of the coronavirus relief legislation could have devastating consequences. Unless this bill is fixed, there is a strong incentive for employees to be laid off. Let's unpack that. There is a strong incentive for employees to be laid off instead of going to work. Well, what is the if there's a strong incentive for you to be laid off, what does that mean? That you're going to quit? Well, you're not going to get unemployment, so that's a dead end. You're going to go to your boss and say, I'd like you to lay me off first? That's not going to happen. That's retarded. It's not going to happen. But they say this is this isn't an abstract philosophical point. It's an immediate real-world problem, Tim Scott and Sasse and Graham said. Yeah, it's a real-world problem for Jews. And you're right. It's not philosophical. It's Talmudic. And this is disgusting. And this strong incentive for employees to be laid off instead of going to work. Get the fuck out of here.
Next 4 months, I'm set. But after that, I don't have a job. And I've spent 4 months out of the labor pool. Wow. Especially in times of great uncertainty like this, where you want to have it. If you're not being laid off, you are lucky, right, with 20% of people losing work. So you're going to want to hang on to your job as best you can. So, yeah, I mean, of course. And this is...
but bro, yeah. Lindsey Graham is just looking out for your best interest, right? I mean, Lindsey Graham, you know, if you're... You have to trust the line here. This is pure line trusting if you disagree.
Yeah, two things. I assume that Lindsey Graham says the word Duggar in more context than one. And also, with the... With the lack of nasal breathing, this guy's not going to catch coronavirus.
No. Yeah, you know, decades of abusing poppers will probably do that.
Oh, my God. And poppers is probably used in more than way than one as well, I would say. Oh, man. Yeah, but this is, you know, this is typical GOP bullshit. Like, you know, this is what I was saying in the early, the first part of the show, is crises like this, when everything is on the line, it shows you. I mean, these people have been transparently fake and gay before. I mean, but a lot of people haven't picked up on that. But in case you're wondering, in case you want to see this on full display, the bill is being held. The shitty bill as it is anyway is being held up by Republicans, also Democrats. But it's being held up by Republicans for one reason and one reason alone. The money that you would be given if you were fired from your job because of the economy, because of the fragility of the Jewish system of finance in this country, if you were going to get a windfall from that of $600, they don't want that to happen. They don't want you right. to be taken care of. They want you to be in pain. So when Trump says people are going to die and there's going to be pain and suffering and suicides, you know, Lindsey Graham is tying the noose with this kind of shit. I mean, it sounds like hyperbole, but it's not. He's out there actively, you know, I hate to use this talking point, but he's basically taking the food off of people's tables, right? Because $5,000 a month is a lot of money, and it's actually a very good amount of money. But what if you have a family of four or five? Then that $5,000 suddenly isn't very much money, especially if you have to rent a two- or three-bedroom apartment from Shlomo and rent or lease or have a loan for a car. I mean, you know, then what's left over, especially if you have medical bills and your job has been lost. And because of the way this, you know, in a recession, in a normal recessionary circumstance, you know, a husband and wife that both have to work, which is another unfortunate scenario, is maybe the husband gets laid off, but not the wife, or vice versa, right? Because the economy isn't impacted in such a total way that this is. But the likelihood is that maybe both people lose their jobs, and this is what you're going to give them. I mean, this is a joke. Anyway, I could go on, but
Yeah, especially when many people are dependent on their employers for medical benefits, right? So the $600 a month, I mean, or $600 a week. Well, I mean, you don't need to have stage four cancer or some severe debilitating disease to run up a good amount of medical bills, especially if you're uninsured, right? Heck, I mean, even having a child in the U.S., if you with good insurance, will cost you $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. And that's just in the birth alone. I mean, there's all kinds of bills on either side of that. So, yeah, I mean, this idea that $600 a week is this untenable commitment, it's really not, especially when you start looking at the amount of money being thrown around in bailouts for these companies that are going to use the money to buy back their own stock anyways and have been doing billions of dollars worth of buybacks in the last decade, you realize, and this is, I think David Frum is right. David Frum tweeted earlier this week that this moment is going to be the death of conservatism. And he says, this is the end of American conservatism. Those under 45 who survived through this crisis will neither forget nor forgive. This is a guy who was, what, like George Bush's speechwriter? This is the Jewish neocon of all Jewish neocons. And I don't think he's not far off the mark there.
No.
Yeah, they're looking at giving, or the airline industry is looking at, or trying to get $50 billion in federal bailouts during this time. You know, companies like American Airlines spent $1.1 billion to repurchase their stock, to do stock buybacks at an average of $32 a share. Boeing, again, also, they spent actually $11.7 billion in the past 2 years doing stock buybacks before suspending them in April. So these companies are probably going to get a great bailout. You know, planes are grounded and they're going to be just fine. But, you know, if you're an average American, you want to put food on the table, or you want to pay for your daughter's dentist bill, you're SOL.
And that's the thing is, and the other problem with us not having access to read this bill, again, it's a we'll have to pass it before we know what's in it situation. We've heard Democrats come out and make some Democrats have come out and made the right noises about stock buybacks. We have Trump coming out earlier this week saying, look, I don't like the buybacks. They're terrible. They're not going to happen anymore. Well, really? Are we sure about that? Or is there going to be another brilliant financial innovation that allows these companies to use their federal bailout money to do more of these stock buybacks? And stock buybacks, for those in Rio Rhinelander, are when a company repurchases shares of their own company in order to inflate the price. And this is just another example, by the way, of just how fake this great Trump economy was. The line was going up throughout the first years of the Trump presidency, largely because companies were buying their own stock and inflating their own value, right? And after the Trump tax cuts, which, I mean, if we're being completely honest, there were some good things in there for some working class people. But this actually kicked off this massive push for companies to engage in more of these buybacks, right? And the largest single investors in this 10-year, 11-year bull market that we had, the largest buyers of stocks were not institutional investors, and it was not individual investors. The largest purchasers of stocks over the last 10 years or so were companies themselves. And dude, if that doesn't just reek of this being a perpetual motion machine that depends on debt and securities and loans and interest, yeah, I mean, this was not built to last, and it wasn't real in the first place.
It wasn't. You want to hear something else they did? They talked about this on Tedious today with Airbnb. Airbnb, of course, has been a sector of the economy that seemingly grew out of nowhere. It's real estate for plebs, essentially, where, you know, it started off. Mike outlined the progression, but I'll just sort of rehash it a little bit here. But it started off as, you know, I'll rent out my apartment when I'm not home and make a couple extra bucks. And that turned into, well, I'll just rent out another apartment and then rent my old apartment full time for people. And then it was, I'll start investing in properties that I can rent out to different people and, you know, make some money off this. Then it was like, I'm going to buy a bunch of properties and, build houses that are specifically for Airbnb. And then the thing that people were doing, the hipsters were essentially renting out large blocks of apartments, at normal rental prices, and then re-renting them on Airbnb, which is usually forbade in most rental contracts.
Right.
And they were doing this. And so what's happening now is, as all of this is starting to collapse, is that these sort of pretend faux landlords that these hipsters were sort of being groomed to become, they are essentially on the hook for all the rent that they owed to the original, the people that they rented these apartments from to make a buck. And they're not getting any of their money back because Airbnb has allowed people to cancel whatever they want. But according to NBC News, as of a couple minutes ago, Airbnb hosts will be eligible to receive small business loans and unemployment insurance through the coronavirus relief bill. So, yeah, they're going to be keeping that whole thing alive and well, too. I mean, this is potentially going to change. You know, that's one of the reasons why we're not doing an in-depth, get into the bathyscaph deep dive and try to get to the bottom of this, because it's probably going to change. It's getting delayed. But I mean, just to give you a sneak peek at some of the things that they're putting in there. It's like this is, you know, in Conservatism Inc. is going to focus on, like, how dare they have testing for shrimps on treadmills? It's like, let's talk about the illegal immigrants. You want to talk about that? No. You want to talk about the Airbnb industry and why all this is so fucked? Now, I will say it is kind of nice to be able to not have to do a hotel in certain places where if you want to do this through Airbnb, it's okay. But this is the problem with the economy, and it's the problem with the economy from stem to stern, is that every one of these industries is ripe for Jewish tricks. And this,
right.
And then in the end, when it's all said and done, after whoever has made tons of money off of this, guess who is on the hook for the fallout? Airbnb being the microcosm example. Like, if people don't want to understand Goldman Sachs and everything that happened with TARP, and they don't want to understand Boeing and blah, 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 just look at Airbnb. It's an industry that didn't exist 10 years ago, and now it does, and now it needs a bailout. Why? Because they never put in place responsible rules to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen. But no, it got overextended and blown the fuck out. It's like, no, Airbnb should actually have to pay for the bailout. Let Airbnb bail out the people on its app. Nope, that's what you're right. going to do as the taxpayer.
Yeah, and I don't mind. I don't really see a problem with people renting out rooms of their house or buying homes and using them as rentals. I think that's, again, we've talked about this before, but this is a way that a lot of middle working class white people build passive income streams for themselves. The problem is when you have these people, again, perpetual motion machine, constant debt, you have these hipsters and people in these big cities. There's actually a documentary about this, I believe, on Netflix, where people will go and they will sign leases, personal leases, saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to live here. Yeah. And by the way, I'm going to live in 10 other units in this apartment complex. And then they turn all of these out to Airbnb, into Airbnb units. And so they accrue this massive debt burden. Where have we heard this before? And overleverage themselves. And then any disruption in the industry, such as this, leads to ruin for them, leads to ruin for the building owner. Like, again, it's irresponsibility, it's mismanagement, and the losses in this case, and this is, you know, just another example of the losses becoming nationalized, right? Where it is you, the U.S. taxpayer, to the extent that you know, the taxpayer is even a relevant concept anymore.
Privatize
is on the hook for it.
Privatize the profits, socialize the losses. That's what the name of the game has always been.
Yep. Yeah. And as another example of the paper foundation that the economy is built on, we had Tom Barrack talking about the fragility of mortgage real estate investment trusts, which are, as you guessed it, basically another Jewish scam. It's where money is lent to real estate owners and operators, and it's either done directly through mortgages and loans or indirectly through the acquisition of mortgage-backed securities. Remember these? So after the 2008 collapse, we are back doing the same thing. And Barrack is talking about how these things are so fragile, and if people can't pay their mortgages, that these are going to go tits up, basically, and this whole industry is going to flip, and there's going to be millions of dollars lost. And I'm just wondering, why is this stuff still happening? Is it, did people learn anything, or do we just live in a country with an economy that doesn't work for anybody except for these people?
No. There were a lot of factors that led to the 08 housing market collapse, right? The bubble collapse with the diversity requirements from the federal government, et cetera. But no, these people and these novel financial instruments and novel financial innovations, all they learned from 2008 was that they could do this with mortgages. So let's do it with car loans too. And let's do it with student debt as well. Now we have, which we didn't have 15 years ago, we have these student loan-backed securities and we have car loan-backed securities. And again, you can imagine these things are being bundled. They're being bundled and categorized, subprime, prime. And now the Fed, this is the big announcement that came out on Tuesday morning, that the Fed is going to be doing an unlimited buyback of all of these securities, right? So if these financial institutions have any of these, I mean, these are the most toxic of the most. You look at the default rate on homes versus car loans, and car loans tend to have a higher default rate than homes. The Fed is going to be buying these things up like it's nothing. It's ridiculous.
In other news, spring breakers have started to test positive for coronavirus, and NBC News has, as Florida coronavirus cases surge, spring breakers start to express regret. And I don't know whether they chose the photo because they didn't want to fat shame anybody else, or this is just the pedigree of your typical, early 20s whammon at this point. But the women in this, the photo at the top of the NBC News article, these women are fucking tanks. Like, the dudes look like they're in good shape. They're throwing up those lifts, but these women just look like fucking tanks. And it's like, I mean, maybe they chose that photo, maybe they chose that photo because they didn't want to fat shame women. But I've seen a lot of these spring break photos, and it just looks like it's like a bunch of like cat ladies in training mixed with a migrant boat off the coast of Greece. And that's kind of like what the modern American college looks like at this point, because they're letting in so many blacks. So many blacks are getting in on free rides. But anyway, we digress. I just wanted to break the ice there with the fact that these people we were talking about a week ago when Ron DeSantis didn't want to close the beaches are now testing positive for the virus. And that's with the backdrop of what? I think that 17-year-old who died, and they tested the person post-mortem and found out that, oh yeah, that person, that 17-year-old that died, yeah, they had a respiratory issue. And that was the coronavirus. Yeah, we found out later. Sorry about that. But anyway.
Yeah, and right. On that topic, I think a health official in Virginia was saying how almost all of the cases that are popping up there are people with diabetes. So, you factor in that photo and what people look like, and you can see why in China, maybe there weren't that many young people dying. But in America, we have all these obese people and, women who the only lifting that they're doing is like lifting a spiked seltzer up into their mouth every 10 minutes. But it's
tipping,
bad, man. Like there's
tipping
a serious
box wine over their heads.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And no law when you're drinking Claws.
Jesus Christ. Claws.
Yeah. Well,
claws are actually, I think those are actually like very low in sugar.
The
keto.
Oh,
those are just vodka and seltzer, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, got the stack of claws and stack of bang next to my fridge, and I'm ready to be quarantined.
Nah, these women are all guzzling like vodka Red Bulls, like the sugar filled Red Bull, and just like Anyway, but yeah, we don't know. I mean, the bailout is going to be massive. What we do know is that it doesn't work for you, and the little bits of it, the tiny little bits of it that would potentially work for you, are being scrubbed from it as we speak by all of the usual suspects. Justin Trudeau has offered his people $2,000 in Canadian dollars, which is $1,400 a month, and I'm sure that that's not going to be a prebate, and it's for 4 months. He's giving them $1,400 a month, and Canada already has a great, pretty good social welfare system up there. So that's in addition to what they're already giving people, and that's Trudeau. But no, not in America. No, you're fucked if you live here.
Right.
So
if you're a two-spirit person in Canada, do you get two checks?
Does Jessica Yaniv qualify for two? Yeah. I don't know. But this is funny. It's another example, like we talked about on the weekend, Jazz, of Trump getting one-upped by Trudeau. Trudeau not only closes the border before he does, but he gives out that bag, that maple syrupy bag before Trump does.
Yeah.
It's great. What a position to be in.
And he'll be very popular for doing this. I don't actually believe the approval numbers that are coming out about the job that Trump is doing. I honestly don't. And I think that as this crisis gets worse, all of the things that he's been saying are going to be coming back to haunt him. I mean, they already are in real time. I mean, just listen to that. Have any objective person who's not a fucking retard listen to that progression montage that I played at the beginning of the show. I mean, how can you, especially if you know somebody who's been sick, it's like, how can you even think that this is a good response to this? It's just not.
It just goes to show, obviously, who Republicans are loyal to, who they're working for, because to any just objective observer, this would be a death sentence to Republican electoral politics. Just those clips we played earlier, everything that Trump has said, the things that all the, Republican senators and, Republican governors in Texas and Florida, the way that they're handling this. I mean, these clips, the things that they're saying and the way that they're dealing with this is going to be just run over and over and over in campaign ads, and they're just giving it away, but they don't really care because they don't answer to the voters. They answer to Wall Street and Sheldon Adelson and these people, the same people who were preventing or who were pushing Trump not to do anything. I'm totally fine with giving Trump credit for messing this up on his own, but we know that he wanted the Dow to get to 30,000, and that's what he was holding off for, and it didn't hit, and then the resulting drop after that was massive. So these people don't work for us, and it's becoming abundantly clear, and they're just basically handing a win over to the other side.
Well, that's the funny thing is, this opportunity exists for either party that wants to come pick it up. The first party to come and introduce the $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month bill, one page bill, no questions asked, let's get this done. This would be, I mean, talk about political capital that you would gain, and talk about, people would love this, right? This would be incredibly popular. It's just so funny that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, and you say they're handing it over to the other side. It's like, I would like them to. I would like the Democrats to come, and we had these Democrat reps and senators come out when this discussion about UBI first began, and Borny Jew saying, yeah, give every American $6,000 a month. And we had Joe Kennedy saying, yeah, $4,000 a month, every American. Where did all of that go? Right? Where did all of that energy go? It's gone. And so the Democrats would have a political golden goose here if they wanted it, but yeah, it's funny. Neither the Republicans nor the Democrats are able to capitalize on this, which leads you to ask why. Whose interests are they really serving? And I just return to what David Frum said. This is going to be the death knell of conservatism, but it's also being taken by the Bernie bros and by the remaining leftists And this is very unpopular with them as well. And we're seeing on Twitter and elsewhere, people like Crystal Ball and Michael Tracy, et cetera, all of them, just the visceral anger people on the left are feeling towards the Democratic establishment for their handling of this. It mirrors ours, and for good reason.
Yeah, and the do you guys think that the longer this goes on, the more of a demand, like, even though this is pissing off people on both sides of the aisle, the longer this goes on, the more of a demand there will be for this stimulus package and some form of fake UBI that you have to pay back, that as demands increase for this, the one side essentially will get what they want pushed through just on sheer panic and desperation from the public. Do you guys think that it works to their advantage to just keep pushing this off so that one of them can basically get what they want?
It does, yeah. I mean, it rams it down the throat of people so that it's like, well, what choice do we have but to capitulate to party X or Y? I mean, they can just do whichever side works out, and it's going to be a shit sandwich no matter how you cut it. And nobody, I mean, look, if there was somebody in this whole shit sandwich who was a serious person, they would actually buck both parties and come out and say, here's my bill on what I propose. Everything else that's being worked through right now is garbage. But it's being framed as the only choice that you have. Either what this shitbag section of Democrats wants or shitbag section of Republicans want. And then they fight and argue over that thing. But nobody is going to go out. Like, if Bernie, like the guy that, you know, he may be behind in delegates, but he still has more primaries to run. I mean, honestly, Bernie's done. But if Bernie Sanders, the one guy who could come out and say, you know what, this whole thing is garbage, and here's my proposal. Why aren't they putting forward different proposals? That seems like the most presidential thing that you could do, right? Even Donald Trump, if he didn't like what they were doing, he's handed it all off. But nobody's coming out there and saying, you know what, here's my proposal on how we fix this problem. Nobody. They're just all capitulating to whatever lobbying groups or whatever collection of Jewish-backed lobbying groups are putting forward. A lot of these people don't even read what's in the bill. And I know that's like a normie talking point, but the reason why is because it's written by somebody else. They're the ones that have to stand up and deal with the animus from the American public. So, yeah, anyway, the whole thing is fake and gay. And how do you know it's fake and gay? Well, why doesn't a serious person, if you're a plan truster, if you're a line truster on either side of the kosher sandwich, if you believe that somebody out there has your back, is secretly your guy, well, why aren't they coming out and proposing their own bill and declaring everything else that is currently being proposed as a farce? They're not, because they're in on it. The end. Case closed.
Nah, bro. Justin Amash is our guy. He's serious. He's the real... the maverick we need. He came out and he tweeted, congressional leaders are wasting time on slow, convoluted proposals. Americans need fast, direct relief. Start getting monthly checks to people now. Provide $1,250 per...
Whoa, $1,250
per adult.
$1,250, wow, bro. You really really just...
Raising the stakes.
Yeah, you just really sweetened the pot there, guy.
Yeah, Justin, up in the ante. And $500 per child for each of the next 3 months, not just two. Take that, Trump. Unless the lockdowns end sooner, after the third month, Congress can renew, modify, or discontinue. But it's like, yeah, okay, where's your legislation, Justin? Oh, there isn't any? Just a Twitter thread?
Oh, all right. Oh, there's only 279 retweets? Wow, very cool. Good job, Justin.
Yeah. You should run for Congress and, like, introduce that bill. That'd be really cool.
Wow, bro, you're a real renegade. In any case, speaking of renegades, let's do a little bit of tell me lies, tell me sweet ADL Jewish lies, what they've been doing. Apache, you brought this to my attention. Why don't you intro this?
Yeah, are we talking about their demands for relief or the
all
you
of
know,
it.
Trying to okay, so
all of it, the whole fucking shit show,
the whole kit and caboodle. All right, so we'll start with this. On March 22nd, the ADL put out a tweet saying, in times of crisis, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to respond and serve communities across the nation. But funds are needed to continue doing so. Join us in calling on Congress to include relief for charities in any COVID-19 relief legislation. So this might be the most ratioed post I've ever seen. It had 147 like last time I checked, 147 likes, 78 retweets, and over 1,000 replies, which were all basically like, "Bruh, STFU, you're the ADL." The top one here was a guy with a black avatar. It says, "Making it a bit hard to view Jewish stereotypes as defamation when you're literally using a pandemic to beg for money, LMAO."
But it's just incredible. Yeah,
in times of crisis, the ADL's there with a spray can in hand and a Hail Hortler on a fresh brick wall.
Wow. Yeah, we also had Jerry Nadler coming out yesterday demanding that the relief package include millions of dollars for museums in New York. So basically, they want your relief money to go to fund like Piss Christ in the Guggenheim or the MoMA. So that these horrible, disgusting pieces of modern art maintain their exaggerated value so that they can be used for money laundering by these people. But there's also this narrative going around. I think it originally popped up in a Yahoo article, but I've seen it on it originally started on Vice, but I've seen it on multiple other news sources since then, which is that white supremacists are urging their followers to infect cops and Jews with coronavirus. And this is basically based off a couple Telegram posts of people memeing about this. And sure, it could be Spurgs, but it could just as easily be federal agents on Telegram. I mean, you never know.
It's definitely something like this reeks to me of federal agents, like tweeting it, screenshotting it. It's like on 4chan when there's the U in the screenshot. Remember that that FBI report a few years back where they had the screenshots of terroristic threats and it was like the responses were U's? It's like, yeah, what you doing on the old company phone there, agent?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is what they do. I mean, I'm surprised that, you know, maybe the bailout money that the ADL is requesting, as we said, is maybe that's for cans of spray paint. I mean, it really, like, their markets are collapsing. The thing that they thought could never happen is happening. And they are making up lies about saying that we want to get people sick when there are people getting sick right now. And they're telling people, we just all need to go back to work to make big line go up, which is going to get even more people sick. The real act of terrorism is to send people back to their jobs in an environment where they could get sick and die from this disease and take it home and kill their parents and kill their grandparents and whatever else. It's just, it's disgusting. And the fact that Matt Drudge, who is Jewish, had this link up at the links cycle very quickly in a time like this when there's a lot of news and a lot of throughput and a lot of volume of stories. But that white supremacist urge members to infect cops and Jews, that thing sat on Drudge for 4 fucking days because they want everybody to see that. That's designed so that people in the GOP see it. And they like, and the other aspect of this is like, yes, all of the illiberal solutions that have to be applied to solve these problems of neoliberalism, the last thing that they want to do, the thing that they're scared of the most, is that all of this is going to lend credence to things that we have been saying all along about open borders, about the financial system, about literally every piece of bias that's being confirmed in the media right now. What do they go out and do? The people who are saying, please keep us shut down so that people don't die. They literally go out and say that, no, we're white supremacists are saying, yeah, they should infect cops and Jews. It's like, no, actually, we're pointing out that Jews are the epicenter of this in New York and that they were careless enough to attend AIPAC and CPAC knowing that they were infected and infecting a lot of other people, infecting people, politicians and pundits and everybody else. It's like, no, we're the ones saying that we think human life is sacred. We think human life should be cherished. And we think that the government should do everything it can to save every life that it can. And everybody else on the other side of that equation is saying, no, back to work, chumps, because this whole system that we set up is going to come tumbling down. And if it does, we are going to have a major problem. That's the crisis that the ADL is talking about. They're not talking about the crisis where somebody you love could die.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the crisis is the fact that they have been a big part of keeping America's borders open and opening them in the first place, making us all vulnerable to a foreign disease to spread rapidly throughout the nation. Not to mention, like you said, where the virus has originated and where the clusters have popped up on the East Coast. Yeah, New Rochelle, New York City, Brooklyn, in Jewish communities, at AIPAC and CPAC. And there was a Times of Israel article last week talking about how the coronavirus epidemic is dredging up all these hurtful anti-Semitic canards about Jews spreading the Black Plague in 1348. And
they did.
And they did. It's all true. And so now, like, when we have a virus that originated in China that was spread on the East Coast by large groups of highly interconnected Jews. And not to mention, we have videos on Twitter this week of Asian people spitting on things in public, and blacks doing like something called the Corona Challenge and going to supermarkets and licking, you know, doing the licking the ice cream and stuff. They are actually doing this. People are getting infected. Jews have been a major source of spreading this in big parts of the country. And they still need to find a way to blame white people. And the ADL needs to ask Congress for money to help them out so then they can use that money to buy congressmen and then go ahead and advocate and lobby for banning free speech on the internet so that they can prevent people from noticing this next time, hopefully.
Look, you know, organizing a large internet defense of Harvey Weinstein is really expensive. Gotta cut him some slack.
And you know, if you don't do that, it sets a dangerous precedent. So, yeah, I mean, bailout money for wine gnats has got to be in the coronavirus bill. And, you know, get back to work, chumps. I mean, all the people that are shilling for this message, it's just, like, unbelievable. Yeah. I saw
platform shoes are not cheap.
Yeah, I saw... Jesus Christ.
Yeah, the Men's Warehouse off the rack, you know, oversized suits, really really racking up the bills.
Yeah, I even saw that Stéphane Molyneux went out and said, what did he say? Dude, manufacturing fled the West because of socialism and oppressive regulations, not because of the free market. Like, Jesus. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Ice takes
China. The scion, the shining city on the hill of open, free, libertarian markets.
Yeah, ice cold takes go burr. Oh, my God. If you haven't had a chance to check out, I don't even know if it's still there, but you got to go check out BRRR.money. You got to check out that site. It's fucking hilarious. It's the funniest thing. And yeah, go check out. Just type in your browser, BRRR.money. It's hilarious. I'm not going to do it right now because it actually plays music. Don't worry. I'm not setting you up to like go to a site, you know, to fucking gross you out or something. No, this is pretty funny. But anyway, yeah. What else? I mean, is there any bottom of the stack stuff here? Or you want to anything else about the ADL or you want to get out of here? What do you guys want to do?
Oh, well, Apache, you mentioned earlier the typical American being morbidly obese and this idea that you need to. If you don't have any pre-existing conditions, you'll be okay. It's like, how many pre-existing conditions does the average American have? Like, double digits? Speaking of, headline from Kentucky, couple throws a fit over not being able to buy 552 cans of Mountain Dew at Kroger.
Yeah, it's like take one item or two items per person, and they wanted 552 cans of Mountain Dew. What is that? Is that, like, that's got to be a certain number of cases, right? So I don't even know what that is. Oh, it's 46, yeah. 12. It's 46, 12 packs. I suppose I'm guessing that that's what they were buying.
I think they had 30 racks in the video, which I didn't know you could get a Mountain Dew, but apparently you can. And also the two people in that movie who were apparently a couple were so fat that they were basically indistinguishable. It was two fat people with long blonde hair wearing wife beaters. And man, it's like the state of the Ameriburger.
This is incredible synchronization for these two. Not only are they approximately the same height, they're both approximately the same width, and they're wearing the exact same white t-shirt and the exact same sweatpants in the shopping market. Wow.
Oh my
God. This is great. But hey, rest assured, guys, I think these are cases of Diet Mountain Dew. So
which also apparently like increases your blood sugar too. So,
trips those insulin receptors.
And these people are probably recent adoptees of the diet Mountain Dew, and they probably are doing this probably all the regular Mountain Dew was taken. I'm sure that's a very popular item. One thing I forgot to say when we were doing the ADL stuff is that they're already starting to in before the narratives that are coming out about, you know, this financial system sucks. Who sucks in this financial system? Oh, look at all the people sitting at the top. Oh, yeah. I'm starting to notice people are sitting at home, Shlomo. People are sitting around. They're looking things up, you know, because the last financial crisis, you didn't have so many people sitting at home. I mean, the effect that you have right now, even though people that are sitting at home are still employed, some of them, most of them, hopefully, is that people are all in a situation right now where they are as though they are unemployed. Everybody is sitting at home. Yeah, maybe you're doing your work from home job, but a lot of people are, you know, all their eyes are on the television. All their eyes are on the evening news. All their eyes on everything. And remember, Stryker has talked about this on Strike and Mike before. The non-voting populace in America, the people who don't vote, who don't participate, who are now being subjected to the shelter-in-place orders for good reason, those people are now sitting at home and seeing what's going on. People that have eschewed paying attention to this shit show of a political process are now starting to see this. It's another reason why the ADL and a lot of people are schwitzing about this right now. But they're also coming out and trying to in before the natural conclusion that a lot of these common-sense thinking non-voting Americans are going to come to, which is that, you know, migrants bring disease. And the fact that this crisis has been concentrated so far in areas with large numbers of immigrants. Why do you think there are explosions of this so far in places like New York, places like Chicago, places like San Francisco? A lot of these places are where, you know, people don't practice good hygiene. Good hygiene is white supremacy. Bad hygiene is basically the turd world. And of course, who wrote this article? I even forget who wrote this. NBC News. Migrants don't bring disease. In fact, they help fight it. So this is like better American than you tier that they're trying to end before. I'm not going to go into the article because, like, who cares? But these are the headlines that people are putting out there. Another one from the New York Times is density is normally good for us. That will be true after coronavirus, too. It's like, whatever you do, urbanites, please don't go into the hinterlands. Don't return from whence you came because, yeah, we don't want to have that. So they're trying to end before all the natural reactions to this crisis, which is like, get me the fuck out of the city. Get me the fuck away from these illegals. Get me the fuck away from all this stuff. Oh, yeah, the financial system sucks. It's like, wow. I mean, you know, you could have had a million of us all online trying to red pill people. And, you know, this virus has done it, like, I don't know, in 6 weeks. Pretty incredible.
Oh, yeah. And I was talking on Third Rail last weekend about how all the countries around the world are tightening their borders and people are demanding more socialism from their government. So we're getting a pretty neat combination of ideologies there. But also just like what I was talking about before, you look at the states that are not hotspots for this, which are, like I said, Idaho, Nebraska, Iowa. These are states that do not have many migrants. I mean, places like Iowa, they're increasing, but for the most part, those are pretty white states. They're also very sparsely populated states. They're not densely populated at all. So I just wonder the cognitive dissonance that people have reading these propagandistic articles and seeing, you know, are you going to believe the Jew at the New York Times? Are you going to believe your own lying eyes? I mean, it's a pretty poor attempt here, too. It's pretty over the top.
It is. It's so transparent. But I expect this stuff to start up very soon. More of this en masse where they try to in before all of the natural tendencies that people have. And it'll come on strong when the restrictions get eased and people go back into the world, because that's when people are going to be sort of ripe to go back to the old way of doing things. And it's important that people are not able to forget what actually caused this and the actual downstream impacts of, you know, the market and not being able to sustain it. And you can't even take a week off. You know, America, you're not allowed to get sick. That's the reality, is you just have to keep slaving away no matter what. to make that big line go up. So anyway, any parting words, gentlemen, or shall we shut it down?
Like the great billionaire Bill Ackman said, shut it down.
Shut it down now. Just shut it down now. Yeah, he's just very upset. Thanks for joining us, Apache. We'll have to do this again for sure. And
this is great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, weekend show coming in hot. We'll be having that, and a lot to look forward to. Thursday, tomorrow, I think you have Mike and the Mad Wop. And then Friday, Tedious, and Third Rail on the weekend, and us. And it's going to be a pretty good time. So stay safe. Don't go outside. Don't trust the line. And hope you guys have a good rest of your week.